Hey, this is Chuck Dixon, and you're listening to Signal of Doom.
Well, you know, for me, the action is the juice. I'm in.
Hello and welcome to Signal of Doom, episode 96. I'm Dave. I'm here with the main man, Stu. Stu, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Dave. How have you been this week?
I'm very well, buddy. Man, I'm looking at you, Stanley t-shirt on, Yankees cap. I mean, you're just kicking it, man. It's good.
Yeah, I had a good day off yesterday, man. I slept so much.
Wow, just a day of slumber for Stu.
Yeah.
Some of us were playing
disappointing Friday night with Sydney weather. Thanks, Sydney.
Poor Stu, went to watch the tennis, went to watch Aussie hero Alex Dimonor.
Yeah, who went on to win. Congratulations, Dimonor.
Lost me money as well.
That lost Dave, Dave betting against Australia.
Always, yeah. Looking to capitalise on a fading star.
In sports gospel, where we've got a chance of winning, like you're willing to back Australia in the cricket where we're definitely not going to win.
You'll
show up to the tennis.
Bet with your wallet, Stu. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
married to the wallet.
You're not doing that at all.
Married to the wallet. And hey, the joke was on me. Alex Dimonor rolled through in straight sets.
Yeah, and then he won the final to collect his very first
title.
And
I'm sure a lot of senior listeners out there are thinking, what's going on in the Sydney International? Well, there's the latest updates.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, and
local Sydney boy wins his first title.
Stu and I actually met playing tennis, not at the Australian Open, a bit lower than that, bit lower level. Stu wasn't
Sydney kind of International, not Melbourne Park.
Trading backhands. But we do follow the tennis still, and yeah, Australian Open about to kick off. Is it next week? Is it like Monday?
Starts Monday.
So tomorrow. Okay, so we're doing a slightly later show this week. So that's going to be interesting. And, I mean, who knows what might happen, Stu. Some gambling opportunities might turn up. I mean, that always keeps it interesting for me. You know, there's going to be a bit of flavour there. I don't know if Stu's entering the market.
Tentatively. I might little dip a little toe in there, see what happens.
I've already dipped a toe. I've dipped a foot in and it got taken off by a gator.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, so this week, Stu, in keeping with my new tradition, we're doing Booster Gold, Volume 1, the Jeff Johns book.
Yeah.
It's one of my picks.
One of your picks?
And that's, notice I'm keeping the tradition of announcing at the beginning of the show what we're doing.
Oh, well done. Two from two this year. Doing well.
Two from two this year. That's 100%.
It's 100%, Dave.
Woohoo! It's only, can only go down from here. One small fucking error is all it takes.
Won't take much.
Now, Stu, what have you been doing? I watched the movie Vice. Michelle was away this week.
I really want to watch that movie.
It's well worth it. I've got
it's
it if you know.
Well reviewed, nominated a lot in award ceremonies. And
yeah, it's funny as well. It's got quite a bit of a sense of humour. If you like American politics like I do, it's interesting. And it's done with a bit of a sense of humour, a bit of satire. Good performances, obviously, from Bale. And Sam Rockwell is funny as George W. Not in it much, but funny when he's in it.
No, I've heard it's good, not quite as good as Big Short, but still well worth
it. I'd give it. I was marking it the other day. It's a 7.5 or a soft 8. You know what I mean?
I'm more than happy with that.
Oh, yeah. It's fun.
Like, I'm not expecting a 10 out of 10, and I think it's going to be a good movie.
Exactly. Godfather Part 2, it isn't, but I mean, it's good stuff. Now, Stu, turning to the news, we've got quite a lot of news. You described the news as crap before the show that I'd compiled, but you said you're having a shot at the news cycle, not me?
Oh, is yeah, it's not.
Well, it's
you're
not
doing,
at me.
You're doing the best with a pile of shit out there. Okay, there's not a lot of great news.
From you, that's almost a backhanded compliment, because sometimes the attack is directly on me, so.
Oh, I don't get me wrong, I have had to delete a couple of stories.
Okay. Well, that's okay.
But I feel like not as much as normal. So,
well, yeah, there you go, man.
This is a good week.
You know what I've been doing all week, and especially this weekend, watching Clint Eastwood movies and playing Red Dead. And I've made a serious impression in both. And I was bound to watch Gran Torino, Stu. You ever seen that one?
Yeah, the Eastwood.
Yeah, watched it again this morning.
That's a great movie.
Love that movie.
He's such a badass in that movie.
He's
I love
so
it.
Good in it. Like, and then I went back in time and I was watching Coogan's Bluff. And I like a lot of his movies. Now, Punisher Season 2 trailer, Stu, came out. What did you think, man? Like, I mean, to me, it was more of the same. I didn't think it was that revolutionary. It was a lot of him walking around and guns firing. That sort of
yeah,
thing.
Pretty much.
I wasn't. You know.
Look, I think the news comes in the fact that this is the first trailer and it's coming out less than a week before the season.
I can't fucking wait. So is it coming out next week?
It's coming out, next Friday.
Hell yeah. I know we announced on the show last week.
So, for me, the trailer's fine. It's same as last season. Yeah, I don't think it's
walking around with, like, fucking machine guns going
on. To me, it the fact that the trailer's coming out this late shows that there is an absolute breakdown between Marvel and Netflix. Netflix aren't promoting the Marvel shows.
Definitely, yeah. There's heat on this show just because it's Punisher and people are following Netflix. But I agree, yeah, they're not pumping it.
No, and look, a lot of early reviews have come out for Punisher Season 2 already.
Oh, really?
And this time they've seen the entire season, not just the first half.
Sweet. Where was our review copy? Where was Signal of Doom? Hook us up, Marvel, Disney, Netflix, whoever. Yeah. Hook us up, man.
Bob, you've been listening.
Come on, I love you. I mean, if you need me to promote more to get this into my hands, I will.
Yeah.
You know, I will.
Oh, we're willing to do almost anything.
Yeah, come on, Bob.
Like, I'm talking like the mousey is tattooed, no problem.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'll wear the musketeers if I have to.
Nice, nice.
I just wanted to be a musketeer back in the day.
So in terms of season two reviews, there's some universal, like, positives and negatives. Every review seems to
be... negatives? What possible negatives could there possibly
be? Well, let's start with the positives. First off, John Bernthal's getting universally positive praise.
Excellent.
They're all saying that his performance is amazing, carries the show.
Excellent.
And they're saying that the supporting cast is all brilliant. There's no weak link in
acting. I liked the girl in the trailer, though, you know, how he was helping that girl out and stuff. It all looked pretty good to me, I thought.
Yeah, and we see the return of, now Jigsaw.
Yeah.
The FBI agent that he was helping out, agent... I can't remember her name.
I don't remember her name either, but I know the agent. Like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they're all...
The one he kind of betrayed. He was sleeping with her and stuff. That one? Was that her?
Jigsaw betrayed her.
Yeah.
Yeah, Punisher didn't.
No, Jigsaw.
So they're all getting praise for their acting.
Good.
On the negative side, they're all saying pacing's an issue, as has been with a lot of Netflix Marvel shows.
How many episodes is it, 13?
I'm not sure, actually.
Hmm. I hope it is. Because this is all the Punisher we're going to get. I don't think we're going to get John Bernthal doing it.
No, and all the reviewers are kind of saying it feels like, just because of the trend of what's happening, they're not going to get another season.
Yeah, sadly.
Now, they're saying that if you enjoyed the first season, you will enjoy this.
Good.
It is not as good as the first season, but not by a lot.
Okay, all right.
So reasonably close in terms of quality.
I'm sure I'll like it.
Some of the reviews actually got quite negative, but it was...
Fuck these people. Why, like, violence?
No, but something? The negativity was more towards the Marvel Netflix shows as a whole than this show.
Okay.
So the negatives tended to be pacing issues with the script. Mm-hmm. They're saying the characters aren't developed at all.
Really?
And I kind of, like, I don't think the Punisher's a developed character. Let's be honest.
Well, I don't know. He's pretty raw.
He's raw is by one note? Is that what you mean?
Well, I mean, taking aside your dislike of Punisher, Bernthal does a very raw, emotional version of the character. See, a lot of people...
But he's only got one emotion.
Well, no.
And it's trigger happy.
A lot of people, like Punisher fans, would refer to Bernthal and the show as like emo Punisher because he's displaying a lot more emotion than Frank Norman. Frank, in a lot of the comics...
I think we need that, though.
You know, I'm just describing what's happening here. Like, you know, in a lot of the comics, through a lot of the years, Frank is definitely rages there, but he's a lot more dead inside. Berthold does a very kind of raw, damaged emotional take, which I respond to. Like, I think it works, but...
Yeah, but we've got the problem in that he's running this entire show, the entire plot is based around one tragedy... Which he just keeps referring back to. Like, he's not going anywhere as a character.
But that's Punisher, man.
Like, he's not growing. He's not developing.
Every good Punisher comic where he reflects on... Not reflects on, but, like, they often do the thing in the park.
I know. And, like, I'm... Personally, that's one of the things that I don't like about the character.
Yeah, I know. That he
but that's what back. A lot of critics are saying that this TV show suffers from. The characters aren't evolving or changing with a new season. It's the same shtick... that they ran in the first season again. If you're a Punisher fan, you'll love it.
Mm.
If you're a Netflix Marvel fan, you'll enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
The critics are saying if you're not a fan of comic booky shows and you're kind of just a Netflix viewer,
sure,
skip it.
Okay, well, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what the audience response is like when it comes out and how it does. I mean, Daredevil Season 3 was very well reviewed. You know, much
absolutely.
Better than much better than Jessica Jones Season 2, for example.
Yeah.
Like, Season 3, I thought... Well, I know I haven't watched all of it, I watched three quarters.
But, I mean, Daredevil Season 2 wasn't as well reviewed as Season 1.
I liked it feels more like Punisher,
but it feels like this is suffering from the second season of Netflix,
okay,
where it's not as good as the first season, and that's been universal.
Well, I'll be the judge when it comes out. I mean, I'm pumped, man.
You're actually going to watch this one.
That's, oh, fuck yeah.
That's a rare treat. Dave's actually going to finish it. Well, he'll watch 3 episodes, give up, and then go back to his 70s shows.
No. Punisher, I watch all of it, man. I dig it heavily. Punisher for me is...
Over 6 months? Is this...
No. You'll actually watch
something within a week?
I'll be watching Punisher within a week, man, for sure. Well, do we know what day it comes out? Is it like Friday night?
Yeah, Friday the 18th.
Okay, yeah, no, I'm 100% down. I mean, there's no doubt on that score. But I agree with you. That's an interesting point you make, and I don't disagree. Punisher as a character in general, he doesn't grow at all. Like, that's... And I hear the point of what you're saying, like, that's why you don't like him, or one of the reasons.
Oh, look, personally, I've always struggled with that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are characters that I'd much prefer that do have other things going on. They've got other arcs they can go on.
But does, like, okay, Punisher is an example of someone who just doesn't. Like, he's stuck there in the cycle of anger and vengeance and rage.
And to be fair to Marvel, he is one of the few characters that hasn't kind of evolved or changed significantly.
Yeah. Now, taking someone else who there are some similarities, does Batman grow? Does Batman ever get past the death of his parents? He does more so than Punisher.
Well, I mean, look, Batman's got the death of his parents, no doubt. Mm. But he's also got significant relationships, and team-ups with other supers. So the great arcs that you can have with Batman being suspicious of other superheroes and having to work with them and be the good guy, and there's a really interesting dynamic there. Mm. You've got the loyalty that he feels to Gotham, the city.
Yeah.
Largely because of his parents and his upbringing, but he's got a loyalty to the city. Mm. He feels responsible for the villains that he has.
Mm.
Punisher, you don't get that. Punisher, if he's got a villain, it's rare that they're returning.
Oh, definitely. That's a huge problem Punisher writers have always had.
Tends to just end the villains there and move on to the next
Jigsaw group. Is one of the only ones to return, and Jigsaw isn't really that great of a villain, like in Punisher comics.
No, there's a couple of crime families that pop up again and again.
Well, there was that Carbones that Chuck created, Rosalie Carbone.
Yeah.
It's interesting discussion.
So you do kind of... And Punisher doesn't have loyalty to a location or a group of people.
I would say that for a lot of years, for many years, he had Microchip as, like, was his buddy in the Man in the Van kind of thing.
Yeah, but what kind of story are we running there? Like, Microchip gets blackmailed, Frank goes after them, kills them.
No, but in the comics, Micro was, for years, for a good 25 years, was his assistant, was his helper... He was his friend. Yeah, they did.
Yeah, but I'm talking about aspects of a character that you can spin off 100 stories from. Can you, like, that relation? It's an ongoing relationship, but it's not a relationship that really generates a lot of great stories.
No, it's generally
and a lot of great content.
In the best Microchip stories, he is there, generally helping Frank.
He's there as a MacGuffin. He's there as the fix all for things that Frank can't do.
Yeah, and look. If we ever read a really good one, when Chuck Dixon wrapped up the Punisher titles, he did one called Countdown, where basically Micro got him out, locked him in a room, basically, to try to get him. Micro had lost faith in the way Frank was waging the war. It's actually a really good story. And, you know, they had problems at the end of their relationship. But in general, for the Microchip stories, he is just his buddy who's helping him with the computer hacking and, you know, blah, 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 that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know? And when you compare that to Batman, he's got nothing.
Yeah, but they're two different characters. I was just querying it. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. Now, Stu, we obviously had this new Captain Marvel. I think it was a TV spot that we watched just prior to the show going on air. I really enjoyed it. I thought it gave us a bit more story detail. The one you watched just before the show started?
Nothing new in terms of story details, nothing that we didn't already know. They named the Skrulls for the first time, which we didn't get previously.
I'd like to see him talk. Samuel Jackson and her talking.
Yeah, there's a couple of scenes there, like when they're in the... It looks like a diner.
Yeah, yeah.
And she kind of blows up a jukebox.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, there's some comedy from Sam Jackson this time around, which looks good.
And also, don't you remember there was that thing about Brie Larson not being able to smile? Well, she's smiling in that TV spot. Remember that thing about how she's so unemotional? That was like...
Look, she was smiling in the very first trailer. I think these were just
sort of like
armchair critics that just wanted to have a go.
Taking a few pot shots. Yeah. She's very unpopular with certain segments of the audience. I think it does, unfortunately, it's a bit of sexism there. Like, I'm not a huge Captain Marvel fan either, but I think
a lot of people are also kind of a little bit over the universal positive praise that Marvel's been getting.
Sure.
Because for the most part, people ignored Ant-Man, which was, honestly, that was their chance to criticise Marvel. That's the easiest place to go after Marvel.
I did. I said for Ant-Man formulaic, was boring.
We know you did. The general consensus wasn't as bad as what you gave it.
Oh, well. I'm a step ahead of the curve, as usual.
You step below the curve, if that's...
But
that was kind of their chance. Before that, you had Black Panther and Infinity War, and we've had a lot of massive success recently.
I think Captain Marvel will be a massive success. Like, I'll be surprised if it doesn't crack $1 billion. I really will.
Yeah, so do I.
I mean, frankly. Look, I'm not that hot on her as an actress either. I share some reservations on her, but I think the movie's going to kick ass, basically. I really believe that. I think that it's going to be a bona fide kind of big smash hit, and these armchair critics, they're going to be irrelevant, basically.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly right.
Now, Venom 2 sequel was greenlit, Stu. Same writers working on the project, Tom Hardy, Michelle Williams, and Woody Harrelson, a.k.a. Carnage, are all returning. This is not a surprise, considering the money that Venom made.
Saying Woody Harrelson's returning is...
Well, he was in the...
For about 4 seconds.
Trailer, but I think he's going to take a bigger role.
He was in the post-credit scene for 4 seconds.
Yeah, but, like there's talk of making a Carnage movie PG. Like, that's going to be
there was
a
talk
challenge.
Of making a Venom movie PG. Let's...
But they did make a Venom movie PG. That movie was PG.
Not in Australia, it wasn't.
What was it in Australia?
It's an M-rated movie.
Okay, but in the States, it was a PG movie, so they made it in the States for PG. That's what they're saying they want to do for Carnage. Like, I think that'll be a challenge for Carnage.
Look, I mean, you know my feelings on Venom. I thought Venom was a pretty garbage movie.
Yeah, sure. I don't know. I'm not a fan either, but made
quite a bit
of money,
and I'm disgusted that it made that amount of money.
Well, I mean, you can't control the box office, man, sometimes. Like, it'll do what it does, dude. Like, people responded to Venom. I was surprised. I thought it was... I mean, I'm the one who said it would go under 400, and I really thought that the movie was poor, and I thought the box office was
poor. I wish it had gone under 400. Like, I was 100% on board for that scenario.
Yeah.
Realistically, it was never going to get that low.
Now, Stu, you've got a bit of news here from Rotten Tomatoes. What's happening?
So they released an article this week saying that last year, the best-reviewed movie of 2018 was Black Panther. So out of the entire year, that was their best-reviewed movie. Now, I don't know how they came to that conclusion and what they mean by best-reviewed.
Because they're idiots, basically, and, like, millions of people are fucking, like, clicking on, like, you know, it's fresh.
Well, see... Rotten Tomatoes is one of the few sites that runs purely on percentages and statistics like that.
Yeah.
So you'd think they're not looking at the fact that it got a billion reviews.
But, like, if I go to Metacritic right now, is Black Panther... Let's have a look at Metacritic, which is a compilation of critical reviews. Let's have a look. I guarantee it's going to be about 83. I reckon it's going to be about an 83, like somewhere in the 80s. That's my prediction of Black Panther. Maybe it's going to be higher than that, but I'd be surprised. Are you bringing up Metacritic while we're talking, Stu? I'm just pretty...
No, I'm not.
Okay, I'm bringing up now. I'm typing in Black Panther. Let's have a look here. My prediction is 83, which should be high, but I would think there'd be other movies that would... It's 88. So that is high, but, is that the highest movie of 2018 on Metacritic, which is a compilation of critical reviews? I'd be surprised if there's not a movie higher than 88 in the whole year.
From last year?
Yeah.
To be honest, I would have thought Into the Spider-Verse would beat that.
Well, but 88 is high, but it's the movies get higher than that. Like, I can try to see sort of, I don't know, like, I'm not... Here we go. Best of 2018. I'm just... So what are you saying about... Do you agree with it, though, Stu? Because, I mean, I don't at all. I think that's stupid.
Like I said, I don't know how they're coming up with that.
Like, Star is Born's on 88 as well, for example, which was released in 2018, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I lose a bit of patience with this. I mean, millions of people... that was a bit of a technical issue.
Dave being a technical idiot.
Millions of people click on the Rotten Tomatoes thing. And maybe that's where they're getting some. Are they looking at fan reaction? Is that what they mean? Like, are they looking at fan? Then because the sheer number of people who are hitting on it, perhaps.
Well, that's what I keep saying. I don't think it's to do... It makes sense if they're looking at how many people reviewed it. But that's not an indication of whether it's the best reviewed. That would be the most reviewed film of...
Yeah, I agree. Look, I don't quite understand it. Like, frankly, I'm at a bit of a loss.
So, I mean, look, Rotten Tomatoes has it sitting at 97% with an average rating of 8.2 out of 10.
And that's high.
So, I mean, 97% means that 97% of the reviews were positive.
Yeah.
That's true whether they've got 100 reviews or a billion reviews.
Yeah.
We're still sitting at 97%.
Yeah.
And
but that reviews, that's fans clicking on it, dude.
That's fans and critics alike.
Yeah.
That is the total...
I don't know about the audience
score gave it an average rating of 4.1 out of 5.
Do you... I trust Metacritic so much more than I trust Rotten Tomatoes, though, don't you? Like, I'm looking... I'm still clicking through the best movies of all time according to Rotten Tomatoes. I'm still in the 90s. But, you know, I haven't got to 88s yet. I don't think I've seen any movies from 2018 as I've been going down. I've seen some 2017 movies. Cold War, December 21, 2018. Metacritic score 90. You know? That's the first... That's 185 on the list. Regardless, I mean... God, Dirty Harry got a 90? I just watched Dirty Harry. I don't know how it's getting a 90. I would have thought more like 75. Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I think that these Marvel movies are being watched by billions of people around the globe. It is a good movie. It's a strong movie. It's one of the strongest Marvel movies. Do I think it's the best movie of 2018? No, I don't. I think it's an important movie, socially important, socially relevant, or ticking a lot of those boxes. But no, I struggle to think that critical compilation of reviews that it should be sitting at number one. Where are you, Stu?
I mean, look, the audience rating seems right on. 8.2 out of 10 seems pretty accurate for me.
Yeah. And like I told you, Metacritic had it on 88. So that's actually higher. But that's just the critical reviews. That's just a compilation of critical reviews.
Yeah, so I'm guessing they're looking purely at the 97% fresh,
sure.
Which means that 97% of viewers thought it was above a 6 out of 10.
Okay.
And I mean, there are some movies that were higher at some stages.
Sure.
Into the Spider-Verse was sitting at like 99, 100% for weeks.
Sure.
They obviously had a couple of reviews below 60, dropped it down, but... Mm-hmm. Look, it kind of makes sense to me, yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know what it says. I mean, we'll accept it, I guess. I mean, I
look, what it says is that this movie is above a 6 out of 10.
What did Avengers Infinity War get? Tell me what Avengers Infinity War got on Rotten Tomatoes, and I'll have a look at what it got on Metacritic. Because I would, you know, predict it would be around the 80 on Metacritic. Maybe it'll be a bit lower. Avengers Infinity War got a 68 on Metacritic.
84% said fresh at a 7.5 out of 10.
Okay, so a significant drop-off. Okay, well, it's accepted. I mean, one thing it does say, though, is there's a gigantic appetite for Black Panther. Like,
I don't think it was a Black Panther thing. I think it was more than that. I think it was...
What then?
A black-led superhero movie. I think the strong female characters. I think there's more than just...
Oh, yeah.
It could have been any one of a dozen black characters that led the movie. I think that's honestly the least important part of the film.
Yeah, the Black Panther.
It's characters like Shuri that made that film do what it did.
Yeah. Again, I feel a ridiculously overpriced character. People talk about Shuri like it was the greatest thing they've seen on screen. I mean, I was like, she was good. She was a good actress. It was a decent role. I didn't quite see it. Maybe I'm just not quite as dazzled by it, but I just didn't think Shuri was that amazing. Like, I thought she was interesting. I thought she was cool. I mean, yeah, but like some of the reactions, you would think like you're watching like, you know, Martin Scorsese's been directing the movie or something. Like, I just didn't think it was anything that special.
I don't know where you're reading this stuff from, Dave. I honestly don't know the amount of fan
interaction Shuri got. Shuri is like getting like 10 out of 10s across the whole fan base. I see it on Facebook all the time. She's a very popular character, and I thought she was cool, but I'm a bit puzzled by... Maybe I'm just a bit not quite in the, you know, in the zeitgeist there. I mean, I thought it was a very good movie. I mean, I think 8.5 out of 10 is about where it is, so I think it's a very good movie too. As you are right, though, that the sell of Black Panther is as much the sell of the social movement behind it, the political movement... The great supporting cast, including Shuri. Like, there's a lot of factors, you know, Killmonger, all that stuff, like, all piled together.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? You could have run a solo, like, Falcon movie or something like that with a black lead character and a black supporting cast. And you could have gotten the same kind of reaction if you had a similar cast.
I think it was important to have the Wakanda be so impressive as well.
Wakanda itself was hugely impressive.
There's a lot of reasons. It's a good movie. I mean, I'm giving it an 8.5 out of 10. Like, I mean, I enjoyed
it. So, I mean, the reason it's the most, the best reviewed film is that it is appealing to every demographic, is what basically what it's saying. It's not a 10 out of 10 film in any one.
Mm.
But it appeals to every demographic. Every possible kind of reviewer will find elements in it that they enjoy enough to give it a 6 or plus out of 10.
It's almost like a...
You look at something like A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
It is a better film.
Mm.
No doubt, it is a better film.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to be above a 6 out of 10 for a 13-year-old boy who's not interested in that genre of
film. Sure, sure. Very good movie, very well reviewed, but I get you. And the box office take wouldn't be as big either on Star Is Born.
No, but box office matters not at all. It's a percentage of how much it matters. It's nothing to do. Like, you can't compare these two things.
Well, yes, you can. You can always compare box office by literally looking at what the movies make. Like, it's quite easy. What do you mean?
Well, no, because you can't compare a $7,000 horror film to a $7 million film to a $700 million franchise.
Star Is Born made decent money. Like, Star Is Born had a decent budget, had a great director, had Lady Gaga as a star. Like,
true, but you look at it as a percentage of investment as opposed to
return
just box office numbers. Box office numbers mean nothing.
They do mean something, Stu.
No, it's percentage and return. That's what you're looking at.
Box office is very important when it comes to translating to how many people saw it as well. Like, to puncture the barrier. Like, Star Is Born made decent money. Like, I bet you it made $800, $900 million at least. Have a look.
You think it made $900 million?
Star Is Born, I don't know. I reckon, I'd say $800. I'm guessing. I haven't looked at the box office on Star Is Born, but I think it was substantial. Yeah, but I mean...
Star Is Born box office, $400 mil.
Okay, worldwide?
Looks like US.
$400 million in the US is very impressive on Star Is Born. I mean, yeah, box office, you know, is definitely...
Not worldwide, $400 million.
Okay, so it's well short. So, look, my point...
That's what I mean. So, like, you can't compare that $400 to a Black Panther $1.3 billion.
Mm. Well, $1.3 billion is incredibly impressive. Like, it is.
It is, but you need to look at it as a return on investment, not...
The Black Panther wouldn't have cost more than probably that $200 million, maybe a bit more to make. Like, it wouldn't have been much more expensive
exactly.
than that.
But A Star Is Born...
Star Is Born wouldn't have been less than $100 million to make. Star Is Born was an expensive movie.
I know. So Star Is Born, say $100
million,
made $400 million. You're looking at a profit of maybe double.
Yeah. I get your point.
Black Panther's like five times your investment.
Yeah. That's
so therefore, via return on investment, Black Panther is far more impressive than A Star Is Born.
Yes, I agree. Completely. That's what I'm saying.
But the number itself doesn't matter. You're not looking at the 1.3 versus 400.
If Star Is Born had made like more, like 800, 900, like I was thinking it might have been, then that would be even more impressive return on investment than what it previously was. All I'm trying to say is you can compare it if you take into account the budget and then look at the end figure. You can compare the two. It's quite comparable.
No, you're not comparing. At no point there did you compare $400 million to $1.3 billion.
Anyway, like moving on. Like
those numbers do not compare. They are completely different.
When you look at it, Black Panther is a more impressive return.
It's a more impressive return, yeah. But that's not your box office figure.
The box office figure is...
That's a different number altogether.
There's no point in laughing at me, Stu. Box office is incredibly relevant because you just then tie it back to what the movie cost to make and promote. Like, and you can get a pretty good...
So what you're saying is box office is important so you can get to the important number.
Yeah, box office is one of the figures you use to judge against it. Like, that's basically like your revenue versus the cost. That's how you look at it. Like, otherwise you wouldn't have anything to compare it to. Like, box office is how you get the calculation. And then
exactly.
go against
the box office is how you calculate the actual important number that you compare.
The other thing,
you do not compare your box office.
The other thing I would remember here and point out is the simple fact it made that much is also how many people saw it and the kind of impact. Like, Black Panther had a social impact, okay?
Yeah.
And that's measured by the number of people that went and saw it and had a ticket and the eyeballs on it. Like, that is another factor in what makes some of these movies classics. Like, a lot of movies, like... are defined by the sheer impact it made at the time. And that's measured these days by box office. And, like, you can see the amount of people that went and saw it. Like, it was like a social movement when it came, when it, came out, and this is coming from someone who I enjoyed it, but like it really made an impact. And that is a way that you can look at these movies. Like, look at something like Transformers, okay? You can judge the rise and fall of the Transformers franchise purely, and Pirates of the Caribbean, purely by box office. The minute they stop getting the return they wanted, they shut the franchise down. They're not good movies, but you can judge the rise and fall very strictly as defined by one thing, which is the box office, against the cost of the movies. That's how you do it.
But Transformers has never been good.
No, but it was very, very, very successful. I agree with you. It was never good, but it was very successful. And the minute it stopped making the required money, same as Pirates, they have to adjust it and reboot it and do all this shit, lose all the expensive actors and restart.
You mean you're not saying anything revolutionary?
No, I'm not. But like, I'm not saying anything revolutionary at all. I'm stating what it should be fairly obvious truths to, like, remind us of that. Because it is important when we do look at box office for this reason. And the same thing with the Marvel movies. That is how they will be defined as time goes on. That will hit a point where they're not getting the critical love. That will happen. And then they will be defined by how long they can survive on the bubble. And the answer to that question is we don't know yet. Like, it's going to be a while, I would suggest. Like,
I think if anything's going to change, it's going to happen very soon.
Really?
Well, Marvel's losing all their biggest stars at the end of this year.
Well, it's going to be interesting.
They won't have a Hemsworth. They won't have a Chris Evans. They won't have a Chris Pratt.
Really think they'll lose them all? They won't cut some deals?
They're trying to deal with as many as they can, but the amount of, like, tier one actors that they're losing just on contracts, it's substantial loss at the end of this year.
I wonder if some of them will be viable. Like, if Hemsworth's Men in Black doesn't soar, you know what I mean? Like, then his value.
Look, Hemsworth's been pretty open in saying that he'd love to work with Taika Waititi again.
Sure.
And do another Thor film if the right scenario opened up.
Hmm.
He's now in a position where he can pick and choose. Because he's not on contract. If the script comes to him and they can promise to book in Waititi to direct, then of course he'll sign up.
And I
think at that point, they'd be able to sign him up for two or three films and kind of get their Hemsworth for the Avengers, for the next team-up.
Do you not think Hemsworth and his team are looking closely at how Men in Black does as well? I think that's an important factor here. Like, if Men in Black bursts, you know, does big numbers.
I mean, look, he'll have another franchise under his belt, but actors that have other franchises.
But, like, when we talk about...
And let's also be honest, he's got enough money to last him the rest of his life.
Oh, but...
Yeah, he's not hurting for cash.
So do all these guys do, but they want longevity in the business. Like, yeah, he's not hurting for cash. Of course he's not hurting for cash. But, like, Marvel, as you say, are trying to lock someone down. Evans looks like he's out.
And the other thing, if Hemsworth truly wants longevity, Men in Black's not the way to do it.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to get way too heavily entrenched in big action franchises.
You mean like do the old one for the studio and one for me kind of policy?
Exactly right. Because you look at some of these older actors. Look at these actors that are in their 60s, 70s plus.
Sure.
None of them are doing the big action films. You can't keep doing that.
Oh, once they're in their 60s
Once you
70s.
Hit a certain age, it just becomes unfeasible.
Mm.
Like Hugh Jackman has already said no to Wolverine. It's way too hard for him to do that role. And there are other roles that he can do, like he did that political role fairly recently, the front runner.
I haven't watched it.
So he's kind of doing those sort of roles now.
Yeah.
And that's what you kind of want to spin off into.
Oh, Hugh Jackman was putting an incredible amount of physical work in, which would get hard as you're hitting like 50 plus.
Exactly. And look at like Hemsworth is clearly doing the same thing. Yeah. Like the dude is ripped in every film.
True. I saw a picture the other day of Chris Pratt. Who'd puffed up a little bit. He certainly had put a bit of,
I think he naturally sits at a pretty hot, higher weight.
Yeah. But he did, they trimmed him down too for Guardians, didn't they?
Well, like, he lost all the weight for Hurt Locker, which he filmed just before Guardians 1.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that's interesting.
And he rolled into Guardians 1.
Yeah, I'm interested, like, purely as a spectator and commentator on the films, like, to see how long and how they adjust. Obviously, Captain Marvel, I mean, Feige was just saying today he's going to be their linchpin, but, hey... It's great to say that, but you then need to have the hit.
Well, yeah, look, they've got a few big name actors that are continuing. Black Panther and Chadwick Boseman.
Mm-hmm.
They've still got Benedict Cumberbatch as Doctor Strange. They'll have Brie Larson as Captain Marvel. Like, they've got big names still there.
They've still got Scully Hansen. They've got a Scully Hansen movie coming.
Yeah, ScarJo's still in there. Like, I think Mark Ruffalo has another film, maybe?
Yeah, he's definitely still attached, like...
I'm not sure if his contract's up or not.
I think he's definitely very buyable. I think your biggest problems are RDJ, Chris Evans, and Hemsworth. I mean,
RDJ I can absolutely see sticking around, but not as Iron Man.
Sure.
I can totally buy him.
Figurehead kind of role.
Head of S.H.I.E.L.D., taking over Fury's role, something like that.
Yeah. And every indication is Chris Evans is definitely out.
It seems Evans is out. If Hemsworth isn't offered the right role, he's out.
They'd be smart to do...
It seems like the Guardians are all out, whether they like it or not.
That's a good point. Well, Feige was saying on the red carpet... we've got more stuff on what Feige was saying, but he was saying on the red carpet there will be another Guardians at some point in the future. That's the classic, like, oh, yeah, we've definitely got it in development.
Yeah, but remembering they've got the other Guardians line up in their back pocket.
Sure.
The kind of cameo we got
Sly Stallone.
Yeah, with Sly Stallone, Ving Rhames. Yeah. Like, there's a...
I'm sure Sly's available at the right price, as always.
I mean, like, that's what I'm saying. There's more than one Guardian lineup, and it is a very flexible lineup,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, true, definitely.
Especially if they go back in the past, they could run a Sly one.
Oh, yeah, no, I'd be interested. They could spin it
off with, like, Groot, Rocket, and Mantis and go forward with a new...
Mm. Yeah, you can do all sorts of things. Like, one thing I would say is... Oh, gosh, I forgot what I was going to say, Stu. There you go. I was thinking of a point, and then I've forgotten it. I mean, that's...
It happens in old age, don't
it? It's a low point on the signal. Oh, yeah. It was... I was going to say, it would be very smart of them to link up another Taika Waititi Thor film. I think that was a really a high point. And strangely enough, Marvel Encyclopedia Drew Gerasi very much didn't like Thor Ragnarok and was talking about on Facebook today because... His reasoning, and I have heard it from others, is he felt it made everything too much of a comedy, including, like, the death of the gods and Ragnarok became a joke kind of thing. The whole movie, you know, there was definitely a comedic tinge to the movie. Yeah, interesting. From such a dedicated Marvel guy, Stu, he really wasn't a Thor Ragnarok fan, whereas I personally think that was a slam dunk of a movie, you know?
Yeah, and audiences tend to agree with you.
Yeah. I have heard the other criticism, but...
There are certainly criticisms against it. But they've also run a very different Asgard in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They're not running multiple gods. It's more or less just the royal bloodline that they're kind of giving god powers or god titles to.
Yeah, they're like superpowers.
In theory, all Asgardians are gods.
Yeah.
And in the comics, Asgardians are written as, like, demigod characters.
Yeah.
All of them.
Sure.
But, like, can you name another Asgardian that's not part of the Warriors 3?
No, I mean, you saw the peasant ones. So are the peasant ones maybe not as strong as Thor, but they're quite strong? Like, one of the peasant ones that was in the end of Thor Ragnarok, if one of them came to Earth, would he be sort of powerful like Thor is?
I don't think as powerful as Thor, because Thor's obviously got the Odin Force or the Thor Force running through him.
Or say Lady Sif, you know?
But, yeah, you look at someone like Lady Sif in the Warriors 3 or... Valkyrie and like they're stronger than humans.
Yeah, Valkyrie's a really good example because she was holding her own on Sakaar. Yeah, she was holding her own big time. You know, like she clearly had powers. Yeah, that's interesting. And I just thought I'd throw that in there for Drew Gerasi. But no, I think it's a slam dunk. I think they working on another Thor movie, the next 2-3 years would be a really strong move for Marvel.
Like, and remembering that. All indications look to time travel in Avengers 4, resetting a bunch of characters dying. They could easily reset Asgard.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very easy thing for them to do if they're already playing around with time travel. And
Thor's dying a bunch so of many guys times back. In the comics. They've done Ragnarok like 3 or 4 times in Marvel Comics.
They could certainly bring back all the Asgardians that died with the snap.
Yeah.
Because Feige actually confirmed Thanos killed off half the Asgardians on the ship.
Right.
Like when he attacked the ship to get the Tesseract.
Yeah.
And then the snap would have killed off half of what was left.
God. And he also confirmed it killed animals.
Yes. Well, it made sense because, I mean, Groot dies and Groot's not human. He's sentient. True. I suppose that's all it takes.
Yeah. Just like ants. Everything. Yeah. All life that's sentient.
I think sentient life is what...
Okay.
Because, like, plants didn't die, so I'm guessing it's not, like, life... In general.
No, it will be interesting. Now, Bob Iger was back at it. He was saying no Star Wars films will be made for the Disney Plus streaming service. He was basically saying, like, they're saving their big budget, because there was a lot of speculation the Obi-Wan movie might actually become an Obi-Wan movie just premiering on the Disney Plus service. He's saying that their big budget movies will always be cinema releases. their mid-budget stuff like Mandalorian, etc., is gonna be coming out on Disney Plus, and that's gonna be the market. He said, and then all
now that's not to say there won't be movies in that kind of universe.
Hmm.
Like if they do a Mandalorian movie, as long as they don't name it Star Wars, The Mandalorian.
Sure.
They just call it Mandalorian.
Do you mean like a TV movie?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, who knows? But he was saying that the big budget ones, he's talking about the big budget Star Wars movies, will, of course, all wind up on the service anyway. He made that point.
Eventually, frankly. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. Now, what did you think of this? John Boyega confirmed that Episode 9 is reportedly a one-year jump from Last Jedi. Apparently, it came out in like an interview about a week and a half ago. So people are running with it as like 100% fact. It just seemed to be something he said, but like that this movie would have a one-year jump, unlike Episode 8, which didn't have a jump, really, or a very brief one.
Yeah, Episode 8 barely had a jump.
Yeah.
There's a few reasons I can think of why this is a good idea.
Yeah.
For me, it gives them an out, which I don't like, but it gives them an out to say that Princess Leia died in that year, and they've already had
food poisoning,
whatever it may be, whether it was a battle somewhere or, but they have that easy out to say that she died during that year. They've had the funeral, and everyone's kind of moved on and forgotten.
Okay, you think that's
like day to day life?
We do know that they're using a lot of footage from Episodes 7 and 8 to cut around her and stuff, and like unused footage. Apparently, supposedly that's what they're doing.
The problem is they never would have shot a scene where she got killed or died.
No. But like you mentioned,
and because they never shot that, if you're going to put her in the film, you've got to figure out a way to remove her from that film or have her see the whole film out and live.
Yeah, which I think would be a huge mistake.
Well, unless they've got enough footage to have her have a happy ending in that film.
Yeah. I think it would be a massive mistake not to kill her off in this movie. I think you've got to bite the bullet somewhere.
Well, I mean, those are the two options. You either have her live a happy ending and have a scene in the final, like a tribute thing.
Sure.
And you let her live, which I think is probably the better option.
So you like the option where she lives through the movie?
If they have the footage.
Okay.
And they're talking about reusing footage from 7 and 8. They've shot.
Mm.
They did do some shooting for 9, but not a lot.
Sure.
Okay.
All right. Interesting.
I think that's the better way to do it. I think killing off a character who died recently and was, you know, universally beloved.
But you've got to do it at some point. How do you explain her absence after that? They're going to run out of footage eventually.
Well, this is the last movie. There is no Episode 10. There is no...
Do you really believe that, though? I see. I don't. Like, I'm cynical. I don't believe that at all.
I think the fans have made that decision. I think the fans have...
Oh, rubbish.
We don't want to continue to see Skywalker films.
The fans have not made that decision. Last Jedi made a fortune. Yes, there's problems, but... I'm cynical. I firmly believe that they'll keep going. Like, they'll take a break. They'll take a breather. But I don't believe this will be the end of the Star Wars saga movies one bit.
I think this is the end of Skywalker and that kind of line of films.
Yeah, but, like, okay, let's say in 5 years' time, you're doing more movies with Rey and stuff. How do you explain the absence, complete absence of Princess Leia without having
killed her? Why would Rey be in that movie?
Well, she's like, part of the universe. What do you mean,
explain the absence? Well, why the fuck would she be in that movie to begin with?
Well, why is she...
If the movie's based around Rey, who's not connected to her.
But she's part of the story. Like, these characters know each other. I'm just saying to you, like, I do believe that's what they will be doing. Like
the characters know each other, but you can make the same argument as why the hell wasn't Boba Fett in any of these movies?
Well, there was that question. Or, there was like, the question of why wasn't Lando in these movies? He's in Episode 9. Like, these questions were raised. They're raised all the time by Star Wars fans. Like, I firmly believe that there's an appetite for more Star Wars.
And do you think
Wars
there was an uproar because Lando wasn't in Episode 7?
There was
people, the one that was positively reviewed, made billions of dollars.
There was,
oh, where's my Lando? Boycott the movie. Lando, boycott.
Are you asking, were fans asking that question? Yes, they were.
There will always be one or two fans that ask
it. But there was quite a number. There was quite a number of fans, especially in
did 8. That movie need Lando?
Oh, I'm not saying it did, but there was people out
did
there.
Did Lando even need to be mentioned in that film for it to be popular?
Plenty of people were asking where Billy Dee Williams was, especially in Last Jedi when the beacon went out. Plenty of people were asking that question. So, yes, that was a factor. I mean, were people boycotting the movie? No, but were they asking the question? Yes.
Yeah, not a critical factor in any way, shape, or form.
Princess Leia is a huge character in Star Wars. She's a linchpin. I think they will have to work a way to get her off the board. Yes. I do believe that as a story. I think JJ will more than likely have that answer. Like,
I think if they decide to kill her in this movie, it's going to be forced. and it's going to be because they don't have enough footage to see her through the film.
Well, I agree, but they still have to do it, though. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's forced because she's dead in real life. Like, if she wasn't dead in real life, the chances of her surviving this movie would be reasonably high, I would imagine. Like, I believe they didn't have any real plans to kill her off, but she's dead. They haven't got, you know, infinite amounts of footage. Apparently they've got enough that she's in the movie. Now, I don't think she's going to be dead in the first, you know, like you're saying, in the time jump. I think she will die in the movie, and the challenge will be for JJ to wrap that up satisfactorily.
You know? I mean, look, we went through episode 7 without any Luke Skywalker for 99% of that
film. Yeah, but like, dude,
it's
like
very
so
easy
many
for them to introduce Leia in the beginning, have her do the, you know, one or two scenes that she shot. Nice introduction to the character. She goes off on one mission. We follow Rey, Finn, Poe, like the new cast.
Yeah.
Whole movie. We catch up with her at the very end for the last 5 minutes. We don't need to check in with her throughout the movie for fans to be...
But are you saying not kill her?
I'm thinking the best option forward is actually to not kill Leia.
Really?
If they've got the footage to do so. And I don't know whether they do.
Well, they've said they have, and they've said they're using it. Look, okay, I mean, I don't know. Do we want to do a
character? I think the other thing is it's always politically a little touchy trying to kill off a character who died recently in real life.
Well,
a lot of movies tend not to want to do that.
Okay, but I also really want to underline this. This is, like, I get what you're saying, that there was some heat on Last Jedi, but it still made a fortune, and Solo underperformed. I mean, I don't in any way think that this is the last we'll see of the Star Wars saga movies, like, by any stretch of the imagination. Like, dude, think of Disney and how they milk and milk and milk and milk forever, and they own all these properties. Like, this movie will make huge money.
Oh, they're 100% going to do more Star Wars films, but I don't think they're ever going to do an Episode 10 and continue the Skywalker legacy.
What?
When you've got a whole range of new characters and a whole range of new stories and locations, and you can start with a non... Star Wars film not titled Episode something.
Sure. Okay. Well,
start it with, like, Star Wars and then have a name and don't start with episodes again.
But the Benioff and Weiss movies are going to be like a trilogy, and they're thinking
from a marketing point of view, they've noticed that when the numbers start to get higher and higher, returns start to get lower and lower because people start thinking, I need to have watched the previous X movies. So Episode 10... from a marketing point of view, won't be as successful as a new, fresh new Star Wars film.
Okay, but
like, even if it's the same cast, same movie, same everything.
That's fine. I accept that completely. But, like, you're still doing a movie set in the same universe with, like, let's assume, like, Benioff and Weiss, no. That's, we think it's going to be, you know, Knights of the Old Republic style. Like, so years before, so irrelevant, like, it won't have the same cast. But if they come back, as we're sure they will eventually, and have the new, what we call, new cast in quotation marks, your Poe Dameron's, you know, et cetera, Finn, Rey, all that, you're still going to have, I would imagine, some continuity. So I'm just, for me, if
you
I'm
can have continuity without Princess Leia.
Okay, all right.
Princess Leia is not an important enough character that the movie will flop without her.
Oh, it won't flop, but I think she's an important linchpin of Star Wars. Like,
she is,
huge.
But she's not so important that she's going to make or break a movie.
Okay,
not on her own. Star Wars has always been about more than a single character.
Why would you keep her alive then? To me, giving her a death is almost like it's an exit point for her. Like, you don't need to reference her in an ongoing narrative. Like, you've given her a conclusion. Like, that's how I would view it if I'm writing
You can
a
have a conclusion that doesn't end in death.
Yeah, but, like, why, though?
Why do you feel a necessary need to kill her?
Because I feel as if otherwise you're going to be constantly sort of like the shadow of the old. And she was old anyway, so it's...
I don't think anyone on the planet is going to be questioning, where's Leia in the next film?
But plenty of people...
No one's going to be doing that.
No, I disagree.
Let's be quite honest. Everybody knows that Carrie Fisher died. They're not going to be going, where's Leia in the next movie 5 years later? Zero people are going to be angry and confused as to why Leia's not in the film.
People would be asking, like, what's the resolution on her? Is it on her character? I do think they will ask that.
You can have her walk into the sunset on a planet that she's living on happily.
All right, okay.
And people are just going to go, okay, she lived the rest of her life on a planet.
All right, as in retirement.
After the war ended, like, happy ever after.
And that's certainly, don't get me wrong, that's certainly an option.
There are so many easy ways for them to end this without death.
Okay, well, that's certainly, look, That's certainly an option. I would blink. That's number two on the option. I think you're either doing the Walk into the Sunset or you're doing a tasteful death, basically.
Like, yeah, and to be honest, tasteful death is a lot harder than Walk into the Sunset.
Like, what did you think of... yeah. But, like, what did you think of Han Solo's death? Because I always found that was slightly underwhelming, personally. I enjoy the movie.
For me, it didn't fit with the character. It wasn't a good death.
Yeah, okay, I agree. Like, I didn't feel that was the world's greatest moment.
No, and Luke's death?
No, I thought it was terrible.
I mean, peaceful, I suppose, but not a good death. Star Wars does not have a great track history of sending out characters Obi-Wan? Well
yeah.
with a fitting death.
Uh-huh. Emperor. Emperor going down the, you know, the tube with lightning coming out and the explosion. That was
yeah, exactly. Nice, but, I mean, the Emperor, you're not meant to feel for the Emperor.
No, I hear your point. I hear your point. Yeah, I mean, I didn't...
Vader would probably be the only person there that you could say had a...
Oh, he had an emotionally impactful death.
A good death.
Hmm. Jabba on the barge.
Yeah, struggling.
Huge explosion.
You're really struggling now.
No, I'm just
thinking... But you see what I mean? Going. Like, their track record isn't good.
No, I agree with you. So, yeah.
And there's a lot more tension with Carrie Fisher because she died in real life.
Mm. Mm.
And there are still a lot of fans out there that are going to be a little raw when they see her on screen again.
Jimmy Terzis, okay, who did Jimmy's Jargon with me, he is the biggest Princess Leia fan out there.
Yeah.
And he was traumatized, and Carrie Fisher, he was traumatized by Carrie Fisher's passing.
A lot of people were. She's a massive part of a lot of people's lives.
Yeah. I love her.
The Fast and Furious franchise.
Yeah.
Paul Walker died midway through filming one movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave him a drive-off into the sunset ending.
They did. They did indeed.
Happy Ever After drives off. Next movie comes out. Zero people are complaining that Paul Walker's not in it.
It's a good reference
and,
point.
And look, I think they put in a line in the next movie where...
Yeah, I think there might have been one line.
They said, oh, the call-out went to everybody. Yeah. Where's Paul Walker's character? And they all went, he's got a family now. He's not coming.
Yeah.
And everyone just went, oh, yeah, okay, cool.
I actually thought it was quite well done in that.
I agree.
Yeah,
and
look,
I think I feel that is the best way out for them with Leia.
Well, she has had a lot of loss. Like, she's lost Han Solo. She's lost her brother Luke. In a sense, she's lost her son. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, to the dark
side. She lost her planet.
Yeah, her planet. Like, in the past, but even more recent years. So what I'm saying is she's lost a lot, and then maybe in this movie... They give her some sort of, like, fulfillment somehow. You know, the events of the movie fulfill her greater purpose and she can have that walk on sunset. I can certainly see it. It's definitely an option. It's not off the table.
For me, that's the best option story-wise.
Okay.
But like I said, it is entirely dependent on whether they shot those scenes or whether they can get a decent enough CGI replacement.
Yeah.
Like, Paul Walker has a brother that looks almost identical to him.
Yeah, it was...
Then they CG'd his face, which didn't require a whole lot of effort.
No.
And it was really well done.
And
it was very hard to tell which ones he'd filmed and which ones he hadn't.
Rogue One's terrible
CGI. Rogue One's Leia was not good.
It was awful.
Tarkin was not good.
I prefer Tarkin a lot more over her. I thought
they spent more time on him, but it still wasn't good.
But Leia turning around at the end was... It really took me out of the movie.
I'm talking the kind of CGI that we see in Captain Marvel with Sam Jackson's face.
Yep, or Civil War, Robert Downey Jr., when they do the 80s Robert RDJ, remember?
Yeah, that for a whole movie, that would be very questionable if they wanted to use him heavily.
Yeah, it would be.
Because you could definitely tell that wasn't his face. But, dude,
I think... I'm going to give you what I honestly think will happen. Stu, Walk on the Sunset, hugely an option, probably 50-50, but most likely in the movie, I think we'll see sporadic at best appearances of Leia. Like, I don't in no way think she's going to be heavy in this movie.
No, she's not going to be heavily featured.
Yeah. Like regardless of whether she dies or not, if you add up a screen time, I don't think it's going to be over 10 minutes. Like, I really don't. Talking about her, more.
Look, I don't know how much they filmed. But it sounds like there's a good few scenes in there that they filmed.
Yeah.
Where she's, like, talking to other rebel soldiers and...
Well, they were saying on Collider, could it be someone's talking to her, like, a massive amount of dialogue, like, cut to, like, Poe Dameron talking, and then cut to Leia, and she's like, yeah, and then go away. So it's like, you know, you're using the tiny amounts you've got.
You could. The other one that they do often is you don't show the actor's face.
Yeah, just over the shoulder kind of thing.
You have Leia walking around and them referring to her,
yeah.
but she's not directly in any scenes with lines because the actress playing
that's
her
dodgy though to voice. Me. That's super dodgy these days because let's face
look,
it.
Look, you can get away with it in a couple of scenes.
Yeah, but we are so
not a long term plan.
No, and we're so like when Peter Sellers died, he was doing one of the Pink Panthers, okay,
mm-hmm.
and he died mid film. The first half of that movie is hilarious. The rest of the movie, it's over his shoulder. It's terrible. And it's just like...
But, I mean, you know, that movie didn't have the option of big-budget CGI fixes that Star Wars do.
What it does have now, though, as well, man, is so many eyeballs on and so many commentators. Like, we are going to pick apart, like, whatever they do. So it needs to be impressive. I think they need to hit a home run, you know, with it. Whatever course they take, Disney, I'm sure, are going to be very careful to try to make this as good as possible.
Absolutely. And, I mean, that's the other thing. That's why I'm kind of hesitant to say they're going to kill her off.
Sure.
I think that's a risky move, regardless of how well it's done.
Yeah, it's a
killing off a beloved character that also died in real life is always a risky play.
Oh, it's a challenging move. I mean, they did it with Han Solo, and I didn't feel like it was a great.
Well, no, because they didn't. Harrison Ford didn't die. That's a completely different.
Oh, I hear what you're saying. All right,
Harrison Ford is still very much alive. So people were like, "Oh, he always kind of wanted to leave Star Wars. No problem.
Yeah, he wanted to cash out one last time.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't like." As traumatized as
And we look
was.
At Luke dying as well, not a traumatic death in any sense,
mm.
but we kind of all go, well, there's still the option for Force Ghost. There's...
Mm. Mm.
And, like, he's okay with the death, it seems. He wants to be back, but he'll do something else.
I mean, we've made...
People aren't as upset and invested emotionally in that character dying because they know the actor's fine.
Yeah, but, like...
There's other films
that... But, dude, like, I mean, we say that, but, like, plenty of fucking Star Wars fans have been real pissed off about Luke Skywalker. So, I'm...
It was more the way the character was treated as opposed to the fact that he died at all is not what they're upset about.
Sure.
It's the fact that he died without getting a decent lightsaber battle. It's the fact that he died alone sitting on a rock.
And that he was barely in it, it felt
the
like.
The fact that he was barely in it before dying as well. It's not the fact that Luke died. There are plenty of ways that movie could have gone...
Yeah.
The end result was Luke dies.
And I would have been
And okay. the fans would have been cheering, saying, brilliant film, well done.
Yeah.
That was a fitting ascender for Luke.
It was almost like, I hate to beat a dead horse, but Luke Skywalker in the new films, it's almost been the most possibly most disappointing arc possible for me. Short of him being full evil Jedi or something. Like,
yeah, you know. And I think the disappointing part is we all know that Hamill has been such a great campaigner for the franchise.
Yeah.
He's been a brilliant asset to Star Wars on and off screen.
But it didn't feel like they treated him like
and
that.
And they
at
didn't
all.
Treat him like that.
No. At all. But it's weird because, look, and
whereas Harrison Ford gets a much more impactful death scene, despite him being very open with the press about not wanting to be in those films.
And look, he's, I mean, clearly the biggest star, but, like, even still, I really didn't feel that, like, Han Solo in Episode 7. Didn't really feel like my normal Han Solo. And I get he's older, but I didn't feel that story arc was that compelling, like in Force Awakens.
No, because they were trying to focus more on the next generation.
Yeah.
He was there linking feelings that you have for the old into the new.
I know it is. It's very test group, isn't it? Like Disney test screening group. Like,
well, it's them kind of trying to play psychology with the audience.
Yeah.
Like, remember how you felt for this character? Well, he's a big fan of Rey and everything she does.
Mm.
He dies, but you can still feel that way about Rey.
Am I wrong to be sort of getting more and more cynical of that? I'm less and less feeling like that's satisfying. Like, to me, that wasn't a sad... Like, I look at the cold light of day, much as I love Harrison Ford as an actor and Han Solo,
isn't the first time it's been done. This is a tried and tested method.
Nah.
I think it's now just impacting movies that you're more connected to.
We give a shit
to.
About. Yeah. Okay.
We're also now getting to the point where we're seeing franchises go well beyond where we're used to seeing them.
Sure.
Like, you look at the franchises of old, if you got to a part 3 or 4, it was already on the massive downhill, like struggling to stay afloat.
They're a bit smarter at milking the franchises in the modern era, aren't they? For sure.
The only exception would be some like horror films, which are at like part 10 and 12 of like...
Sure. And they have
like a Nightmare on Elm Street gone to like part 10, I think. And
Friday the 13th, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're going there. But it's a very different take on massive blockbusters because they can cycle through an entire cast in a movie. No one questions it.
I mean, I guess the questions we've got, like, I'm excited for the future of Star Wars. So in a way, getting rid of the old is natural. And to be honest, I'm quite embracing of the new stuff as well. So I understand. Like, I just wish they would do it a bit better. Like, I just didn't feel Luke Skywalker was done very well. Like you're saying, it wasn't really his death that... It's not the problem.
The fact that he died is not the problem. It's how he died and how they treated him while he was alive. That is the problem in that movie.
I always feel like the one good moment... Like, I remember this as a kid. Like, Luke turning up in Return of the Jedi in the black uniform to go into Jabba's palace. I was like, Luke's finally a badass after spending two movies kind of being a bit of a whiny bitch. You know, like, in Return of the Jedi, I was like, man, Luke's really kicking ass. And then suddenly we get to now, and it's like Luke was like just this grumpy old guy, like,
yeah,
you know. And I was really like, man, this sucks. This could have been so much better. But I guess part of that is the fact that they waited 30 years, you know, and all those great, you know, fucking potential Luke Skywalker storylines never got filmed, you know, really. Like, that's part of the problem.
Like, yeah, I mean, look, they decided to run with prequels as opposed to continue on.
Sure. And surely Harrison Ford and not being part of the deal was a problem for them. Like, you know.
It was, but they made decisions to do one thing instead of another. Like,
sure.
They absolutely would have been the option to move forward and continue with Star Wars films.
Yeah.
But they went back to fill in.
I wonder if they
I felt was a more natural conclusion to do.
Yeah.
When they'd had movies that were kind of labeled 4, 5, and 6.
Yes. And they built it up, all this shit about the Clone Wars. And then, wow. Anyway, and
execution wasn't good, but the idea behind it originally, running with the prequels, is a better plan, I felt.
I'll never forget Kendall Davey turning up. Was it 99, Shoe Phantom Menace? And I was so eager. I was an eager little beaver. I had my Star Wars cup, and I remember being in the cinema going, it's okay, my brain. And then I'm like, hold on, this sucks. Anyway, look... Just last in the Star Wars stuff, Scott Mendelson at Forbes, he does a lot of kind of wacky articles. He states a survey that Star Wars Episode 9 is the third most anticipated movie of 2019 after Endgame and Captain Marvel. I wanted to get your take on that, Stu. What do you think? Where is Episode 9 in relation to Endgame and Captain Marvel? Are you having it at 3? What's your ranking? I'll give you mine, but you do yours first.
Endgame is number 1.
Sure.
And I think by a long way.
Mm-hmm.
For me, Captain Marvel is 2.
Okay.
But I can absolutely see that would be 3 or 4 on most people's lists.
Sure. And you've got Star Wars at 3.
I can't think of anything else that would be better than Star Wars that's coming out this year. There are other movies that could rank highly for other people.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
You know, some people would put things like Lion King, Aladdin up there.
Definitely, definitely.
You've got Detective Pikachu in the Pokemon realm. That's going to be a big film.
Sure.
He's
just talking. He's trying to do some sort of like
survey. But in terms of like massive blockbuster films, you'd expect those 3.
I'd have Endgame 1, Star Wars 2, Captain Marvel 3. But to me, Endgame's the one that's out in front by a long way.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a massive DC fan, Shazam probably gets a look in there as well.
Sure, and a certain segment Joker, but I mean, not mass audience. You know,
I don't think. Yeah, not when you're looking at Joker massive blockbuster.
My friend Dion, the Joker fan out there, will be fucking all over that movie. I can see it now.
I keep thinking of Joker, kind of as a smaller indie kind of film.
Yeah,
it's not. It's got a big budget. It's like $50 million budget.
Speaking of movies with de-aging, The Irishman is coming out soon. Scorsese is directing it, and De Niro, Pacino, and Joe Pesci are all de-aged apparently throughout the entire movie. Apparently, it's got a huge budget. He's used his new technology and stuff. Like, it's going to be very interesting to see what it's like. Like, they're going to be de-aged, like, pretty much for the whole thing, which I find it's going to be...
I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, I'm fascinated, I mean, by it, but do I think it's going to work?
Personally, I think De Niro's lost his edge.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, De Niro's one of the greats.
And don't get me started on Pesci.
Pesci's retired.
He lost his edge in the 80s.
Well, Pesci's retired. He last came back to do one thing for Scorsese about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
He's been retired, and I mean retired, counting his money, living in Florida, retired.
Yeah.
But that said, De Niro's lost his edge, but he's still capable of something. Same as Pacino. I mean, he's an old guy, but...
For me, Pacino's the best of the three currently.
Sure.
I think De Niro was better than... Was the best actor in his day.
Incredible body of work, but the minute he started doing Meet the Parents 2, he probably started
to just take he's the gone money. Down into the comedy rom-com kind of take the easy option.
To be fair, can be funny in them because he's Robert De Niro. He's not completely dead inside, but he almost is. You know,
you kind of see the first movie and go, "Oh, it's De Niro doing a light-hearted comedy," and that's an interesting take.
Yeah.
The next five films that he did in the same vein.
Thank you.
Flop.
Go watch Bad Grandpa, whatever it's called. Like,
oh yeah, don't go.
Don't. Yeah, because you see a guy who's just going, "I've got the cash."
Like it's in the bank something account. Like The Intern, I think, which he did romantic comedy with him and Anne Hathaway.
Oh right, okay, I haven't seen that one.
Where he's kind of playing the old man who interns at the tech company.
Oh, I think I might have seen this. Yeah,
yeah, okay. It's an absolutely forgettable rom com, but it's him in a somewhat comedic role,
fish out of water kind of thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
Look, picture that five times over, and a couple of them are incredibly inappropriate.
To be fair to Robert De Niro, that's just where the audiences went. His body of work in the '70s and eighties is cutting edge. Same with Pacino. I mean, they make movies, Stu, that I go back and watch. You know, and you absorb yourself in, and they're fantastic. But I am interested in what Scorsese can do with it. Because, I mean, Scorsese attached with these guys, I am fascinated. It is coming. It's a Netflix release. I believe it's getting a very limited release, so it qualifies for award consideration.
Mm-hmm.
It's costing a lot of money. They're not disclosing how much, but for a Netflix movie, serious amounts. And the de-aging technology must surely be a factor there. That I'm sort of fascinated to see what that looks like. Because I can imagine that. You see it and you're like, oh, dear. Yeah, that could really...
The other thing is all their voices... Yeah. Change. You need to de-age the voices as well. So,
well, Pacino's voice has definitely changed a lot over the years.
Well, they all have.
Yeah, they all have. Really. I mean, Joe Pesci 10 years ago was unrecognizable because he. When I say retired, like these guys are allowed to like step off the treadmill like he did and go, "I'm done with Hollywood. I've got enough cash."
Yeah.
And Scorsese got him back for, I forget what the movie's called, for a smallish role, and he didn't look like Joe Pesci. You know what I mean? If I looked at him, I'm like, oh, that's Joe Pesci. It didn't look like Joe Pesci at all.
Yeah.
And that was 10 years ago. So God knows what it's looking like now. I mean, he's alive. That's all we know. Now, Stu, there was some the Dune remakes. Have you ever read the Dune novels with Frank Herbert?
No, I haven't.
Sci-fi? I was a big fan of them when I was a teenager. They get progressively more complex and hard to read, but the first couple are very interesting. Now, how do you pronounce his name, Stu? Is it Stellan Skarsgård?
Stellan Skarsgård. So, the same actor that plays the clown Pennywise in It.
Oh, is it? Is that who he is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, I thought it was an older guy. The same guy who played in Thor. I thought it was that guy.
Oh, which Skarsgård is it?
Cause it's the older one, man. I saw the picture. Anyway, he's playing the villain Baron Harkonnen, who's like the big one... The story of Dune, if people haven't seen, it's actually really interesting. It's set in the future, and it's rival houses, like rival House Atreides, Harkonnen, et cetera, and they sort of divide up space and sort of they compete against each other, and the Harkonnens are kind of like the villains of the piece. And in the original movie from, back in about 1980, Patrick Stewart was in it playing the Emperor. And there's really was it Max von Sydow? It was someone like that who was in it playing the villain Harkonnen then. But I think it's the guy from Thor, dude. I think it's the doctor, you know, the professor, whatever his name is. The guy.
Stellan Skarsgård is the
okay.
The uncle. There's a whole Skarsgård family, like Bill Skarsgård and Alexander, the two younger ones.
They're very accomplished.
So Bill plays Pennywise in It.
Yes.
And Alexander was the new Tarzan.
Yeah. They're a very accomplished Swedish acting family.
Yeah.
They're like legends in the home country. And also, as well, Stu, Dave Bautista is headed to Arrakis. That's the planet for the Dune remake. He's reteaming with the same director, Denis Villeneuve, from Blade Runner 2049. So yeah, I don't know what...
Denis Villeneuve.
I don't know what part he's playing, though. I don't know if that's been announced, but certainly it has been announced. And luckily for him, after his brave comments, Stu, if we could ever forget his overreaction to James Gunn's firing, like his lone gunman stand there, abandoned by everybody, it felt like.
And after he had 1 or 2 years where he was picking up roles in a bunch of action films as kind of a silent, funnily enough.
Yeah.
Big guy. So he was in Spectre with Bond. He played a silent guy. He was in Blade Runner where he played a silent guy.
I was going to say, he wasn't huge in Blade Runner. I remember where he's in it, but it's not like a massive part.
No, because the guy isn't a great actor.
No, he's a wrestler who got lucky.
He's a wrestler who's not as good as The Rock, still.
No, definitely not. Nowhere near. But anyway, Stu, just coming from your angle, you've not read the books. Have you seen the original movie, the David Lynch directed film from, I think it's about 84?
I watched the original film.
It's confusing.
And I'm a
massive
fan of Denis Villeneuve's work.
Like, you are?
Oh, yeah, hugely so.
Because I think you'll probably enjoy Stu. Stu's a bit of a thinker. Aren't you, Stu? You're a bit deeper than me, some would say. And I would, honestly, Stu, as a teenager, I read the Dune, like everything. You know what I mean? That Frank had a lot of Frank Herbert's work. It's actually really interesting, and it's actually a bit philosophical as well. Like, it's not just space opera. It's space opera, but there's a lot of deeper questions asked and stuff like that. Like, it's actually a really interesting universe. And, I found it super fascinating. Like, the movie with David Lynch is extremely flawed, very flawed. But the original couple of books in the series, like I'd say the first four, are extremely readable. There's a lot of interesting concepts used. Frank Herbert was a very gifted writer. My question is, Jude, this was leading to a question. Are you going to the cinema to watch it to June when it comes out, say, next year? Are you in cinemas?
Yeah, I would. I'd love to see this.
Well, there you go. Two of us. Maybe it'll be a date, Stu. I don't know if Michelle's going to be available for that movie.
No, I'm on it, yeah.
World's least.
But, I mean, look, Denis Villeneuve, he did Blade Runner 2049, Arrival, which I thought was brilliant.
Yep.
Sicario. Like, he's done a lot of great films.
Did he do Sicario?
Yeah.
I did not know he did Sicario.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. Okay. So, what have you got to hear about Blizzard?
So, Blizzard, the game company,
mm-hmm.
Who make World of Warcraft,
yep.
have paid tribute to Stan Lee in the latest update.
That's cool.
They put in an NPC, non-playable character, called Stan Lee, who, grey hair, moustache, walks around as a knight, and all he says is Excelsior, and then walks around saying that.
That's classy.
So, there's just a little... you've got to be in the right place to know where the character is.
Yeah.
But he's got a little loop that he does, and he says Excelsior and kind of walks away.
I love that kind of thing.
So it's a nice little nod to Stan from a company that hasn't been connected to Marvel.
No.
So it's just a nice tribute for someone in a similar geek culture.
Yeah. Oh, and he deserves his kind of nods, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm really... The more I think about it, like, everyone has to die sometime. And I'm glad that, like, when his time came... The overwhelming consensus has been very positive. He's very well regarded, and a lot of people are doing affectionate tributes, you know?
Yeah, whether it's Marvel, whether it's DC, and now we're getting, like, it's spreading to things like Blizzard, who are massively successful World of Warcraft creators.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. And, I mean, there's how many fucking fans of that would there be worldwide? A lot, wouldn't there? Can you imagine?
Oh, there's millions of people to play. Yeah. Millions.
They're relaunching. One of the guys at work was saying they're relaunching... World of Warcraft, I think he was saying, it's a remastered edition, I think, but also taking away a lot of... I know exactly what he was saying, but basically there's been a real call, a real push to release World of Warcraft as it originally came almost out of the box without all these enhancements, and they're doing that again now. Blizzard are doing that again now, I think, with some graphical upgrades. I don't play the game, so I'm not familiar with exactly what the push was, but apparently... The hardcore World of Warcraft players had felt it gotten a bit diluted, I believe. And anyway, so Blizzard are doing some sort of a relaunch, sort of almost back to factory settings kind of style relaunch of the product. Which
that's
I think
a pretty cool idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a rabid fan base, you know. That this fan base is... I kind of dig... I'm not heavily into that culture... that PC gaming culture, but I dig that the studios pay such close attention to the fans. And, like, if they don't, there's a fucking rebellion. You know, like, we previously saw Diablo when they announced that thing for phones, the mobile devices. And, like, there was that... Don't you remember? They did it at the press conference, and guys were going, is this a fucking joke?
Well, people get a lot more attached because you're actively investing in it.
Yeah.
Like, when you're playing as a character, you are actively involved in that world.
Yeah,
so you do develop a bigger attachment than you do watching a film or...
It's true.
Or
it's
watching true. A TV show where you certainly...
You're a spectator.
Characters.
You're a spectator. If I'm watching S.H.I.E.L.D. on DVD or whatever, much though I'm enjoying it, you're essentially a spectator. You put me in a game where I'm playing in that world, I'm acting in it, just like you're saying, S.H.I.E.L.D., like I'm playing Red Dead Redemption, like I could do about like 6
far
hours.
More invested.
Yeah, heaps invested.
And when you're looking at investing hundreds of hours into a game, if the game's not good...
Yeah.
You'll go through the bare minimum story points and then kind of finish it, never look back.
or if they take your game and I turn up in Red Dead Redemption tomorrow and they go, oh, we've introduced cars. You're like, whoa, slow down. You know what I mean? Like, you've got this buy-in to it. Just like you're saying, you become familiar. Like, imagine, Stu, I played Red Dead Redemption for about 6 hours, like, today or over the weekend, okay? I've split about 6 or 7 hours. Now, it's been fun, but if you put a camera on that with, like, you watching what I was doing, it wouldn't be that fucking absorbing. Because a lot of what I'm doing is literally riding around from story point to story point, a few shootouts, this and that. But because I'm playing it and I'm in it, it's heaps interesting.
Yeah.
But if you were watching a video of that, you'd be like, wow, this is dull as dishwater.
And it's often why a lot of comic book movies have suffered.
Mm.
Because the stories in comic book in game, PC games into movies have suffered.
Yes.
Because the stories in PC games don't have to be brilliant. The characters don't have to be that well-rounded.
Mm.
Because you're playing, you are far more invested.
Yeah.
It becomes a good game, even if it's got a mediocre story.
Yeah, I hear you.
Whereas a movie's mediocre story, people aren't going to rewatch that. People aren't going to spend a lot of money.
I think Assassin's Creed, which I thought had a lot of potential, they just... There is a story in Assassin's Creed that's interesting, but by trying to make it the sole focus, it just really displayed like how shallow their vision was. Like, I almost feel Assassin's Creed was another example of how not to do a video game movie, you know?
Like, well, it's weird because Assassin's Creed, the first game, the story they ran with in the movie wasn't the story from the first game.
Yeah, I don't even remember the first game. No, like
in the first game, it was a mystery right until the very end, and you kind of figured out why he was continually getting strapped into this machine against his will.
The Animus.
You didn't figure it out until the very end that... Like, they were basically after a race of advanced beings that had come hundreds of years before.
Really? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's like almost an alien kind of invasion.
I've not made it to the end of the first game. Are you kidding?
No, that's the twist. That's why it's pretty fucking cool film.
Dude, I've played...
The movie didn't do that at all.
No, because I've played, like, a lot of Assassin's Creed 1, but then I jumped to Assassin's Creed 2, and I've played a lot of Assassin's Creed Origins. I haven't played much more else than that.
And after the first one, they kind of just went... that didn't really work. Let's make it all about just the Creed.
Right, yeah.
And then every game since then has just been about the evolution of the Creed.
Right, okay.
And the greatest assassin of that time.
Look, I find the games pretty fucking interesting, but I thought that would have been a pretty cool story.
Yeah, it was. A lot of people were loving it.
Yeah.
But you didn't get a hint of that until, like, the last, say, hour of gameplay?
Yeah, okay, yeah. All right. Well, that's spitting me out big time because I never made it that far. That's full on. I thought it was all about like the Animus and like sort of like a Matrix-y thing, and like I could never quite understand what was going on. But like,
well, the mystery was always why did they choose him to go back in time and relive that character?
Mm.
Like, why would a company living now be interested in the life of an assassin?
Yeah.
1,000 years ago.
But, like, they go back even further. Like, I'm playing Assassin's Creed Origins now. You're back in ancient Egypt.
Yeah, because now the story is looking purely at the Creed. When did the Creed first form?
Mm.
Why is it here? What has it been doing? They're not interested in the rest of the world.
This is Dave playing 60% of all the games. And not
whereas playing. In the first one, it was more the Creed is a...
Like an alien thing.
No, the Creed itself was just a way to figure out what's happening in that time.
Mm.
It was more about the setting than it was about the Creed.
Yeah, massively. I mean, I played a lot of Assassin's Creed 1. Most of the time, he's just rolling around Jerusalem, killing.
Yeah, but the reason they were strapping him into the Animus the whole way through was because there was that advanced race that was kind of just under the surface.
Fuck.
Living under Jerusalem and...
Fuck.
...that area. That's why that...
Shit.
And they're saying that that's why, like, civilization and technology advanced so quickly
I think that
in the
could
Middle
be
East
for
in that
real
time.
Life. I think that in real time.
Yeah. Well, I'm not even going to touch that.
Wow. Stu, blowing me away here and making me think...
A game that's a good 15 years old at this point. That.
But I've played a lot of Assassin's Creed.
Just never finished Game 1.
No. And, brutal honesty, haven't quite finished Assassin's Creed 2 either, although I got quite far in it.
I'm not sure you've finished anything, Dave.
No,
GTA. Have you finished anything?
GTA games, thanks, mate.
Oh, well done. Yeah.
Thank you.
I won't mention anything on TV.
That storyline, though, is proof of what I'm saying. If you'd done more cool action scenes back in Jerusalem or wherever and then tied into that story, that would have been really cool. But it was all about... It was just done really...
See, for me, I'd much rather see the version of the film where they strap they basically kidnap Fassbender.
Yeah.
Strap him into this machine against his will.
Yeah.
And have him kind of continually wake up in the Middle East in, you know, 1,000 years ago.
Sure.
And realize that unless he goes along, he will die in this world. Have it, like, do a Matrix kind of thing.
That's totally what they should have done.
Wake up after the first incident of being in a fight, cough up some blood and realize that it's real. It's not just all in his head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he takes it seriously, goes back into it, realizes he's got to follow along to survive. And then have it kind of like a massive twist at the end where it's a alien conspiracy or whatever they want to run with.
Mm. That would have been so much... But I thought that's what it was going to be, that kind of style. But it was really dull, whatever they did do. I watched it with
the problem with Assassin's Creed, the game was, a lot of people did what you did. They get halfway into it and go, it's not really doing anything new. I don't really want to continue to do what I've been doing for the last 10 hours.
It was fun.
It's fun enough when you're starting out, when you're learning all the moves.
Yeah.
But once you're 50, 60, 70% of the way into that game,
I get you, yeah.
Nothing's happening.
Yeah.
It's kind of more of the same, so people just gave up.
Yeah, and to be fair, Assassin's Creed Origins, which I'm loving, I've taken a break from to play Red Dead. But it is a compelling franchise, but yeah, it does suffer from...
Timing's a problem.
Repetitive nature to it, big time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I mean...
But there is with a lot of those games. If you look at how much repetition there is in Red Dead that you've been doing...
Far Cry. There's repetition in Red Dead. Red Dead's really making an attempt to make it be more like a movie. Red Dead's really trying to go for a Western movie feel. Almost too much at times, but like GTA is an example. GTA 4 and 5, where I felt that they told pretty cool storylines, although they were a jumble. Like GTA 4 has got a lot going on. It's got a hell of a lot packed into that game, you know?
Oh, but story-wise, it's piss poor. Let's be honest.
Well, I don't know if it's piss poor. That's an exaggeration. It is. I mean, there's big fucking threads in it. Like, I was totally confused. Oh, man, I'd forgotten what I was doing by the end, and people are popping off left, right, and center.
GTA games aren't known for their story. The story is not good in any of those games. That's not why anyone buys the games.
No, I agree.
They're so fun and great to play without having a story.
Yeah, agreed. Okay.
They're not going to
delve down
and have a deep dive in stories.
But, dude, Red Dead is from the same
company. Meet a character, and you're like, hey, you're a little bit spastic today. What's wrong?
Okay.
I'm a drug addict. Okay, well, that makes sense. Let's move on.
Agreed, but I want to raise this point to you, Stu. Rockstar Games, which do Red Dead, which is on the same engine, okay? Red Dead Redemption definitely does have a pretty full-on story to it. They've made a real effort to integrate the story much more into the game in Red Dead 2.
And are you having more fun because of it?
No, less.
Exactly. Exactly, my point. You don't buy those games for the story.
I'm a roamer, dude. As soon as I could get out of, like, as soon as I was told you could start roaming, I was like, thank fuck, and, like, fled the camp in my horse.
Yeah.
Because, like, the beginning of the game, I had to do this trek through the wilderness. I just hate having to do things that are in, like, a movie style. And I'm like, man, let me roam through the territory as a roam solo guy, which is what I like to do.
Exactly.
And now I'm doing that big time. But it does make an effort to do a few different things. I don't know. Some people are raving about it, dude, saying it's like the greatest story of any video game ever. I'm like rolling my eyes a little bit at that, frankly. Like, you know.
Yeah, no, you're honestly always going to struggle to compete with some of like the Final Fantasy games.
Yeah, okay. I'll tell you what's got a cool story. Battlefront 2 in the campaign mode, it's relatively short, but it's a pretty cool... It's cool, you know what I mean? I'd say the Uncharted games had a pretty cool story. I always felt the Uncharted was a pretty wicked fucking... I mean, great gameplay combined with a cool action story, you know. But you're right, maybe a lot more of sort of the Asian sort of flavour games, you know, are renowned for having some decent storylines behind them.
Well, things like the Final Fantasy series have always had, you know, massive stories behind them.
Yeah.
And they've always been rated as some of the best of all time.
Yeah, I think they've still probably got that thrown over. Having played, I think I'm at about 45% of Red Dead, and I'm a guy who enjoys the side missions. Like, I'm one of those guys. Like, I like going out doing all the different things and the shootouts and this and that and doing jobs for different people and all that kind of stuff.
You've always got to run that balance of if you want the characters to be completely personalized, like in Elder Scrolls, you can't have a strict story plotted out because all the characters are going to treat everything differently.
Yeah,
so you can't have them always run into the same problems.
Yeah.
Because for some characters, it's super impactful. Like, you've got to kill off a friend character that you've had.
Yeah.
Like, that's a big deal if you're playing the White Hat. But if you roll into it going, I'm just going to kill everything and anyone,
right?
Be a total Vader. Suddenly, killing an ally is not a big deal. It's more not a big style. Story point.
Nobody cares. I always play the mercenary kind of guy. Yeah, okay.
So you can't script a hard story with something like an Elder Scrolls.
Well, Skyrim had that one about the rebellion. And then it had the rebellion story, and then it also had the bigger story about...
Yeah, but it's not a hard scripted story, so it's not great.
No. It was okay,
they're not
though.
Trying to be great. They're trying to make it completely personalised.
Yeah, I thought it was okay, though. Like, I mean, you know...
Whereas something like Final Fantasy, where you are playing a character...
Yeah.
And there's not a lot you can do to change what the character does, or...
Yeah, see, I prefer the one where you've got... Look, I'll explain what I like. I like the sandbox games, you know, your GTA style. That's my preference.
Yeah, so you're not going to have a great story in any of those games.
No. Yeah,
agreed. You can't.
That's
because
the
character is meant to be customizable. You're meant to be able to do anything.
Yeah. We're getting
so the stories are going to change depending on how you treat the character.
Is it just me, Stuart? We're getting into some deep territory this show. Is it because we're recording on a Sunday?
If you call this deep, you've got problems.
Oh, this is super deep for me. You're doing thoughts that I'm
fucking skin deep.
Wow. Well, welcome to my fucking depths.
Oh, wow. Okay. Dave's plumbing the depths of the puddle. Yeah.
My sister always says shallow as a puddle.
Yeah, we're agreeing with her right now.
Yeah, oh well. Okay, Star Trek IV, reportedly shelved by Paramount. There's been a lot of problems. The director apparently left it at the Game of Thrones prequel, where there'd already been problems. I think Chris Pine at one point had exited, hadn't he, or at least hadn't signed.
The Star Trek franchise hasn't been blowing anyone's minds.
Certainly not the movies. Some people are enjoying Discovery quite a bit. Apparently it's doing quite well on CBS Access.
But it always feels like it's been... second fiddle to Star Wars of late.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Maybe these movies are dying a natural death, Stu, and they can go back to TV where they are now with the Discovery and, you know.
Quite possibly. And then in a few years, they'll try and reboot it again. Whole new cast. See what happens.
Now, also, the Star Trek boss said that Picard leads a radically altered life in the All Access series. This is the sequel series, dude, which Patrick Stewart's going to be doing Picard sort of...
yeah.
You know,
a 1,000-year-old Picard.
Yeah, so apparently he's revealing a cataclysmic event depicted in J.J. Abrams' 2009 Star Trek movie impacted Picard in a big way. In that film, written by Kurtzman and former producing partner Robert Erke, it was revealed that Nemo's Spock failed to save the Romulan homeworld Romulus from a supernova several years after the events of Nemesis. Now, Kurtzman, as part of a Creative Space interview with Hollywood Reporter, is ready to reveal one massive clue about the premise of the CBS All Access Picard effort. Quote from him, Picard's life was radically altered by the dissolution of the Romulan Empire.
Thanks for reading that twice.
Well, I mean, that's... I mean, the Picard...
This is where copy and paste is not your friend,
It
though.
Is my friend, and
this
I'm trying
really
to...
really not.
Trying to give listeners a full fucking insight into what's happening, Stu. The Picard series will be the first on-screen Trek story set in the aftermath of that event.
Oh, wow.
Which would have
it's
effectively...
after the event, which radically altered his... This is amazing stuff, Dave.
What does that mean? Like, what about the movie?
It means the same thing in three different paragraphs
what does that
you
mean?
Just read.
But, okay, it happened in Star Trek by J.J., the first movie. Well, we had Star Trek 2 and 3.
And yeah.
So, aren't they post? Oh, yeah. I guess because Picard's in a different universe is why. Picard's in the universe that Spock came from.
Yeah.
The old Spock. He's still in that universe, whereas the universe that J.J. Abrams...
You're the one catching up here, Dave. Okay. We're all...
Okay,
we all know what's happening, because you've read it out three times
I guarantee
now.
You, listeners, the Star Trek universe that J.J. Abrams has been playing in, I believe, is called the Kelvin timeline, and that's being effectively, you know, stopped with Star Trek.
But you remember in, I think, the most recent Star Trek movie, Chris Pine lands on that iced planet and runs into Leonard Nimoy as Spock... in the cave.
Okay.
Do you not remember this?
No, not at all.
Useless. Just useless.
Not at all. I thought he met him in Star Trek 1. I fell asleep in Star Trek Beyond.
Of course
he did. In the cinema, so I missed a lot of it. Well, I'm confused now. Like, so what the fuck's going on? Like, just because...
I'll tell you what's going on.
Explain, because I'm real confused.
Yeah, okay, man. So... There's going to... what happened is Picard's life was radically altered in one of the previous movies, and they're going to address that in the new movie. This is all that we get from four paragraphs of copy and paste.
No, but it also...
There was a radical alteration in his life.
Okay.
And they're going to adjust for that.
I want to quote this.
You've quoted quite a bit, Dave.
A separate paragraph.
Oh, good.
One of his goals as Captain Enterprise was seeking a peace between the Roman Empire and Federation.
Groundbreaking stuff.
Picard, no, I'm explaining, because this happened like 20 years ago, man. So we'd have listeners who weren't even have been born when this episode of Next Generation aired. Picard teamed with Spock during the events of the Next Generation two-part story Unification. This is like season two Next Gen, in which they learned that Romulans claiming to seek a peaceful reunification with the Vulcans were actually planning a secret takeover. I can't even remember what happened. And in the events of Nemesis, Picard faced off with a clone of himself created by the Romulans. Well, okay. Thank you for that fucking history lesson.
I'd like to apologize to anyone listening. I should have deleted this entire news.
Well, you probably should have.
This is on me, and I apologize for that.
This whole thing
should have been gone.
I don't know what it's established.
I should have reduced it down to a single paragraph.
I wouldn't describe this as a huge scoop.
Neither would I. who put it in the news, Dave?
Well, I copy and pasted it because it hit the news feeds going, it's radical news about the Star Trek.
And once again, you didn't actually read it.
I did, and I was confused. I was like, I don't know what's going on.
So why did you put it in the
news? I wanted to be on the bubble.
If you read something and have no fucking clue what it says, why would you then read it out?
Because I knew it was popular and I was trying to, you know, play to the fans and give the fans looks.
You're the kids in my class that I love to fail. I actually get a sick pleasure out of going,
Why?
You have done nothing to benefit yourself or the class. We are all dumber for having heard this news.
We do know that Picard's coming back. We know that the effects of the destruction of Romulus seem to have hit him very personally for some reason. End scene. I never really realised that Romulus was so important to... The Romulans were so important to Picard. I thought it was just a couple of episodes in like a, you know, 10-year run. But apparently he's taken it all very personally. So I hope it's not the main focus of the series. That could be a boring series. Like Picard is sitting around like, I can't believe Romulus is gone.
Dude, he's 1,000 years old. He's not going to be doing much more than complaining in a chair.
Oh, Patrick Stewart's still got a bit of game.
Really?
I like Patrick Stewart a lot. I mean, he's not...
His last movie was brilliant because he was in a
chair.
Old
Man Logan.
Yeah. The guy literally didn't get out of his chair, which is great for him.
But... Picard was never an action hero. He was always a thinking man's Star
Trek captain. He's going to be in a chair.
Yeah, make it so. Take us out, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's going to be pretty boring to watch unless they spice it up with other characters.
I hope they do.
They have to.
Are you going to be watching it?
No. Do you want me to think about that? No, not.
Well, I can tell you something I'm going to be watching.
I'm not a huge fan of Star Trek in general.
I know.
I've seen the movies.
I know you're not, and this is why you're having
I've gone and seen the movies, but I'm not going back to the 60s plus to watch every episode of every season of... That's a massive commitment, and I'm not there.
I can't imagine you doing that. If I walked into Stu's, like, deep in episode fucking season 3, episode 10 of the original series, I'll be like, you're struggling for Forbes, Stu.
Yeah. There is so much better TV on right now.
Next Gen was very good in its time in the 90s. It was a very good show in the 90s, but that was a 90s budget, like, you know, sort of... thing of the week. Like it had some really good episodes.
And I've always felt like when you've got a show that's a spin-off of a spin-off of a spin-off and it's season 8, there is so much viewing that you have to do to kind of catch up that it's not worth the investment.
If you haven't watched the Next Gen
And that
TV
is why
show.
They've lost me. There's a good 5 or 6 different versions of Star Trek TV shows.
Yeah.
All of them have multiple seasons.
Oh, yeah.
As a starting point, you can start at episode 1, season 1, the first thing that aired. But that is such a big investment to get to the good stuff.
I wonder if they've made Discovery more accessible. Maybe they've tried to. I mean, Star Trek does have a fan base, but I agree. It struggles, I think, to bring in like a lot of new.
They struggle to bring in new, and that's what the movies were meant to do.
Yeah.
Bring in new fans and then have a spin-off TV show which kind of continues their love of the...
Like, this Picard thing feels like a step back to me.
It's the same way as a lot of people view comic books.
Right.
Like, when you've got decades of comic books and multiple lines with the same characters...
Yeah.
Finding a starting point is not easy.
Oh, I agree.
And, the goal was always run the Marvel Universe on cinema, have some TV shows back it up, like S.H.I.E.L.D. and then the Marvel Netflix shows...
Yeah.
...to get fans involved, and maybe then they'll make the transition, but...
But every report seems to be that that's not happening.
It's not happening because comics are very intimidating when you've got to find a starting point for, like, Punisher, and you're not willing to go back to issue one of Punisher.
Yeah, it's sad because, like, for Punisher, you really don't need to. You really don't need to.
Well, no, Punisher's not a great character. That's a bad example on my part.
A good writer can make Punisher very accessible. It's more challenging.
When you've seen any Punisher, you know the entire backstory.
Avengers. Say Avengers. That's tough to make accessible. The Avengers title.
Fantastic Four, like any where you've got team dynamics, it's much tougher.
Yeah. Okay, Stu, big news, and I'm very excited about this. Margot Robbie will play Barbie in a new live-action movie. I am 1,000...
I know why you're excited. Let's move on. I'm
1,000% into this.
Of course, you are.
There's more information. According to Variety, the story is along the lines of Enchanted and Big, and the main character finds herself kicked out of Barbie land and thrust into the real world. Amy Schumer was originally lined up to play Barbie in the movie when it was set up at Sony before the studio changeover. It was expected to open in 2018 summer, but the date has been pushed. Reports now say Barbie is slated for a May 8, 2020 release date. Stu, are you in cinemas watching Barbie starring Margot Robbie?
No. I can tell you the only reason why this made the news. Can I put the only reason why this made the news?
Sure, what?
The first two words of this article. Margot Robbie is the only reason you were remotely interested in this.
Well, yes. I mean, is that a fucking surprise?
No, it's not.
Okay. Universal came
It's amazing that you're not on some kind of register somewhere.
Well, it's not a crime to like Margot Robbie.
No, it's a crime to like her that much, though. That's...
Yeah. I take offence to that, Stu.
She's
an amazingly, you know, beautiful woman, and she's a gifted actress and good producer. Like, give it up to Margot Robbie, and she's Aussie.
But
and she's an Aussie as well, so she gets
Barbie
all the
Barbie the
picks.
Movie.
Yeah, what about it?
You're struggling.
Oh, look, I mean...
You're struggling.
Barbie, if you're telling me there's new Barbie movie, no, I'm not excited. You tell me about Margot Robbie, and I'm like, well, that's just great casting.
Of course you are.
Anyway, that's look. Hey,
put it this way: would that news have made it?
Here we go.
If Amy Schumer was there,
well,
in the original cast,
Amy Schumer was cast.
Yeah, so the original cast,
and I did write in the news, and I believe you deleted it because it was Barbie news.
It's terrible news.
Well, okay, but you deleted it, so take a good hard look in the mirror yourself, I guess.
I'm 100% behind my move
because with me, stuff like that, I see Barbie news. I know it's popular. That goes straight in the news.
Popular with who?
I don't know. People. But Margot Robbie, very popular, especially with comic book fans, straight in the news. Any move she makes, in the news. You know, production-wise, acting-wise, etc. Now, Universal Cable Productions has inked an overall deal with Grant Morrison. Under the deal, Morrison will work with Shiro to develop and produce original content for television networks and streamers. The newest project will be developing and writing his long-running comic series, The Invisibles, for television. This is fantastic. Set in 2020... The series follows an elite international cell of occult freedom fighters dedicated to the creation of a better world by any means necessary. Now, Stu, this is we'll definitely be doing Volume 1 of The Invisibles on the show shortly, and I am so excited that he signed this deal. Now, currently in production is Season 2 of Happy, based on Morrison and Dagan Robertson's graphic novel of the same name. They've got the guy from Christopher Maloney. The guy was originally on... Law and Order SVU for many years. And he's, like, basically the series follows Nick Sachs, a corrupt ex-cop turned hitman whose life is changed by a relentlessly positive, imaginary blue-winged horse named Happy, voiced by Patton Oswalt. It was a comic series that then spun off into the TV show, which is on Netflix now. And it's really exciting news for Grant Morrison that he's inked this deal, though, and Invisibles is happening, Stu. Because I'm telling you, Invisibles is a fucking great series, man. Like, Happy is... It's weirdly enough, it's almost just like one of his more minor works. If you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was apparently quite popular. So it just goes to show, you get your foot in the door, and Grant Morrison's starting to get out there with this deal. I'm very excited. Now, Stu, you've got some news about the Golden Globe Awards. Kevin Feige...
No, that's you, Dave.
Okay. Was asked about the X-Men and Fantastic Four becoming part of Marvel Studios on the red carpet.
Can't remember your own news.
The truth is, I'm excited for all of them. I'm excited, and it's not just the marquee names you know. There are hundreds of names on those agreements, on those documents, on those agreements.
Thanks, Kevin Feige. Breaking news. Mm. Breaking news here.
And the fact that Marvel is as close as we may ever get now to having access to all the characters is something I've been dreaming about for almost 20 years at Marvel.
I'll tell you what, Marvel can get closer. They can actually have it, which they're going to do.
Sure. Well, I guess...
I don't get this comment.
Spider-Man is the one that they haven't got and are unlikely to fully 100% get. But, well, I mean, he's just saying the deal's about to close. So
I feel like those six words is all we needed from Feige.
Oh, there was a lot of
spinning it out here.
There was a lot of questions that were peppered into him on that Golden Globe interview.
Oh, absolutely, there would be.
We've already reported on some of them during the show, man. Like, I mean, it was interesting. Now, James Wan was being questioned on the appearance of Atlantis in Aquaman. Some people were pointing to a plot hole where Aquaman had visited Atlantis in Justice League. He quotes, "It wasn't Atlantis. I spoke with Zack Snyder early on, and Zack mentioned the location that Aquaman swims to in Justice League is an outpost." This old excuse. So,
I mean, this is a real struggle.
Yeah.
Because James Wan had him going into Atlantis and looking amazed that there were underwater cities.
First time ever.
Like, oh my god, there's cities under here?
And then Jackson was like, oh no, what he went to Justice League was an outpost that just called itself Atlantis. Yeah. So when he told me that was the idea, I was like, oh great, then I can actually have Arthur go to Atlantis for the first time. I wonder if that was a real conversation.
Yeah, no, it definitely wasn't.
Yeah. Also, Stu, Kevin Feige on the Golden Globe spoke about James Gunn. It was in place before we started developing the movie, or just as we were developing it. So Doctor Strange says that line, Endgame, because we knew it was the title. And they were also asking him about James Gunn, and he was like, more power to him. He makes cool movies. I'm sure he'll make a cool Suicide Squad. He made some sort of diplomatic remarks because they were sort of trying to like get him to... get into a bit more detail. Finally, Stu, the conversation turned to Adam McKay helming a possible Silver Surfer movie for Disney, which is on the verge of acquiring all these Fox properties. McKay, who helped write the screenplay for the first Ant-Man, has expressed interest in tackling a movie about the surfer. He's an honest-to-goodness fan, said Feige, revealing that Marvel did help McKay in securing a small Galactus cameo in Vice. I look forward to speaking to him more. Then we had this weird thing by Zack Snyder. He has his T-shirt, man, for a very good charity, suicide prevention charity, recalling that Zack Snyder's daughter, sadly, committed suicide, I believe, last year. Now, the T-shirt had a graphic on it with full of all these weird symbols, like sort of like mixture of like almost like DC logos and stuff. One Vero user, because this is Vero's his social media platform of choice where Zack Snyder posts all this shit up, named Eric M. Blake, commented on the post of another user who was sharing the graphic. Lois conceives at the farmhouse where she and Clark catch up on lost time after his resurrection, and she's pregnant throughout Justice League 2, Bruce Blake continued. Batman saves her by trading gunfire with Darkseid, sacrificing himself to save the world, and she gives birth at the very end, and Lois and Clark name their baby son Bruce. Snyder replied to their comment with an applause emoticon. That doesn't necessarily mean Blake nailed what Snyder was trying to communicate in the graphic, but Blake might have. At the very least, Snyder likes Blake's idea. What are your comments, Stu, on this
one? I have absolutely no fucking clue what this story is about.
Okay.
Like, I've just read it and heard you say it.
Yeah.
Basically, and all these sentences don't seem to make any sense together.
Let me explain again. I've already explained it, but for the second time.
You tried. Okay. Zach was wearing a T-shirt with symbols on it for suicide prevention.
Wrong. He designed a T-shirt for suicide prevention charity, and he posted a picture up of it on his Vero user account, okay?
And one guy decided to spin that off into a whole story.
Yeah, well, it has all these symbols, sort of like a flowchart. Like, it's almost like an organizational flowchart at work, and it has, like, Wonder Woman symbols, Batman symbols, all this shit, like, and, like, skull and crossbones. Like, it's a flowchart using symbols instead of people's names, okay? And so it goes to a starting point and to an end point. And then one guy looking at that kind of got that whole explanation, and Snyder gave him the applause emoticon. And, or M-O-G, or whatever you fucking have you pronounce it these days. And, like, and people were very excited because they were saying, is this what was going to happen in Justice League 1 and 2? To me, it's a stretch. I just thought it was a cool story.
Massive stretch.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's for a how can I say, it's for a, like, a good cause. So I, you know, I'm supportive in that sense. Now, as reported by CBR at this year's CES in Las Vegas, I won't even go through it all, but basically, like, Audi, okay, potentially may have spoilt who saved Tony Stark in Endgame, Stu. You know, in the Endgame trailer, how Tony Stark's floating out in space.
I do know this.
Well, potentially, they've got this experience called Marvel Avengers Rockets Rescue Run. It has the movements of an Audi translated as a spaceship's movements being piloted through an asteroid field by Rocket Raccoon. Now, it appears this potentially may have been Rocket Raccoon's in the movie saving Robert Downey Jr.'s character. and the vehicle will make an appearance in Endgame. So similar to Lego, who, you know, are famous for, you know, spoilers through their toy products, there's a potential that this could be a spoiler for events in Endgame. What do you think?
I think there's zero chances of spoiling anything.
Really?
Yeah, Rocket's definitely not doing that.
Okay. Why? Well, what's your reasoning there?
How is Rocket going to get out there?
I don't know. I don't know.
He was teleported to Earth by Thor using the Bifrost. Okay. So Rocket is on Earth with no spaceship or means of travel.
Is Rocket there with, like, Captain America and stuff in Wakanda?
Yep.
Okay. So he's a long way from a rocket.
Yeah, he's in Wakanda. Wakanda would have some kind of spacecraft, but sure, there seems to be far more likely options of rescue.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I mean,
plus, this is just a VR experience.
Mm.
Rocket's just the best space traveling guy they've got currently.
Yeah, I hear you. He's the pilot. If it's not him, it's Star-Lord, you know? And Rocket's probably more popular, you know?
Rocket is more popular than Star-Lord. And, yeah, they're not going to give a lot of details to Audi. Like, Lego,
I don't think so.
Massive.
Yeah.
You can't understate the impact that Lego's got.
Sure.
They're huge.
Yeah.
Audi doesn't have a massive impact on the comic book industry.
No, I hear, man. I hear.
Audi's just
sponsored. Okay, I thought I'd stumbled on a scoop. When I first saw this, I was like, man, I'm going to blow Stu's head away. But like, you're totally unruffled.
There's nothing going on there. That's just a nice little...
Well, I mean, this could have been
a nice little partnership between Audi and Marvel, just making a little VR game.
I do remember when I went to Singapore, the Universal Studios, the VR game of Transformers was awesome. You know, a good VR experience can really be amazing. Now, wrapping up the news, Stu, I was in JB Hi-Fi, and I don't know if you've seen this. Blu-rays and, like, 4K films of, like, totally different genres have movies like Predator have Deadpool on the cover. There's a whole range of movies that Deadpool is kind of, like, is sort of, like, incorporated into the movie. I was looking at this Predator.
Yeah, so think, like, alternate covers for comic books.
Yeah, yeah.
Now Deadpool's making a bunch of alternate covers for DVD movies from the same studio.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Yeah, I was looking at it, at the one from Predator, and I'm just looking at it going, what is going on here? I was confused. And like, some of them made more sense. Like X-Men First Class had one where he's wearing his jacket that he wears, you know. But yeah, I thought it was a pretty nifty little move. So I guess all Disney movies.
No.
Oh, it's Fox.
Deadpool. So
Fox. Yeah, that would make sense. Okay, right. Now I'm starting to get more in tune with fucking life. Like,
now he's understanding it.
Yeah, now I'm getting it. Because, yeah, Predator is a Fox property.
Yeah.
That was what was blowing me away. I was like, wow, how is he doing this? Like, yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, would you want to own one of those? It would be kind of cool to have a few.
And that's exactly what they want you to do. They want you to go out and buy movies that you've already got on Blu-ray and DVD.
Yeah, but to get the Deadpool.
To get the Deadpool cover art.
I'm not going to do it because I'm too cheap, but I can imagine people who... no, I am. I'm not going to do that. That's a fucking move of, like, a guy who's just, like, burning money. You're one step away from burning cash. Like, it's only the cover.
Well, first off, they'd love you to get people to rebuy movies.
Sure.
The other one is they're putting it on classics that the teenagers don't have.
Yeah, popular.
So they're trying to hit up the 15, 16-year-olds that love Deadpool.
Too. Popular
that want to go and purchase these only because Deadpool's on the cover, and then they get to enjoy the first Predator movie, which is brilliant.
It's a fucking great movie.
Yeah.
I think it was also on... I'm not even sure if it was the first Predator movie or if it was the new Predator movie that I was looking at. The Predator.
Oh.
I don't know. I actually don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, if you're considering buying that, don't.
They had a lot.
Buy the original Predator twice instead of buying the new Predator.
Oh, yeah. I've got a Blu-ray of the original Predator. It's fantastic. Yeah, anyway, I thought it was pretty cool. Stu, we're finally at Weekly Comics. That was a lot of news this week, man. Like, I felt like Lois has been fucking busy, and yet it was also, in a weird way, a dead news week.
It was terrible news. There just seemed, like, to be a lot of it.
There was just a lot of, like, join-the-dots news is what I call it.
And I cut a couple of stories. I should have cut, like,
glad
half
you did,
of that.
Because I was getting...
I really should have cut more.
I was getting actually tired at
Well,
one
you got to stop copy and pasting paragraphs of information, redundant information into this.
All right. Well, okay. Let's take that on board for next week.
Oh, look, an article that had to fill up their word count. Let's take all of this.
It's like my comic book reviews.
Yeah, where you're like, what's my word count? All right, let's do 50 more than that.
Yep.
It's exactly what all these people are doing.
Yeah. The end of the comic was... start really broadening. Well,
there's a contraction there. Let's expand that out.
Yep. You're a teacher. You'd be familiar with these techniques, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You've seen it a million times.
Oh, yeah, but I get the kids that aren't that smart, so they just make the font bigger. And they're like, it's 5 pages. And I'm like, yeah, it's like 1 page of actual content.
Wow. Those kids have got lots of
learn. Put some pictures in there. Let's make it look impressive.
Kicking off this week, we had Young Justice 1. Stu, I'll hand it over to you. What did you think of Young Justice 1? Bendis, the return of the Young Justice team for the first time, I think, since Rebirth, New 52.
Didn't hate this, which I kind of thought I would. Generally, the team-up of the teens doesn't do anything for me.
Okay, yeah.
But the same as Marvel did the previous week, where we got the kind of Young Avengers team-up.
I preferred the Marvel one.
I preferred the Marvel one, but this isn't bad either. The Gemworld concept's cool.
Yes, I thought that was
the best part. I actually really like that, where they've got the kind of warring factions of Gemworld.
Yeah, and she was a big character in, like, the 80s and stuff, so to bring that back is cool.
I thought that was pretty cool. Some of the characters got a bit on my nerve. The Kid Flash was annoying.
Impulse, yeah.
Impulse.
He is annoying, but Alan.
Not a fan.
I tell you what, story was fine. I liked the appearance of Gemworld. The dialogue, to me, is so weak. Like, Bendis has everyone doing... I think I described it as, like, imagine bad Spider-Man banter from everyone. All comic. That's what it felt like to me. It felt like everyone's got one voice. It's exactly what Bendis gets criticised for, and it's exactly what he seemed to do here.
Yeah, it's... I don't think it's as bad as you're saying, but it's not a strength.
It's not good. Like,
it's not great.
From a guy who, when he got on Ultimate Spider-Man, was getting praise for his dialogue, it just feels like Bendis has gotten, I don't know if lazy is the word, just so formulaic and so reliant on, it's bad banter, but everyone's doing it, and it could just be the same guy talking. Like, it's like there's no split of characters almost. Like, it's very, I found it, it drags me out of what otherwise was a reasonably enjoyable story.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Yeah, I'm giving it 6 out of 10, and frankly, if he tightened his dialogue up and got his character voices down, this could be much higher than that. You know, I just feel he lost like a point and a half on dialogue.
Yeah.
Almost, like, which isn't a positive for Bendis. Like, again, I think Bendis coming over to DC, it hasn't quite been an injection of creativity like I was hoping. I still feel like he's getting towards finding his feet, but I still feel he's got some way to go. Maybe he's just doing too many books and he's just that burnt out that he just can't do it anymore. Like, could it be that? Is he just completely burnt out, do you think?
I honestly feel like just this is what his style is.
This is just it, yeah.
And I don't think he's putting a significant amount of effort into these stories.
No.
I feel like he's doing this as part of his contract.
Churn and burn, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, he's got other stories where he's doing much better.
Yeah.
Think like Cover,
where the dialogue's a lot better. Yeah, very interesting, yeah.
I think he's putting more effort into things like those.
Okay.
And these kind of titles that he's forced to do.
Yeah.
He's working them. He's doing okay.
We should do, to give some, we should do one of his Spider-Man, Superman trades. We should do either Action or Superman. Do like volume one of the trade soon so we can get a taste of what that's like. Because I've been talking to like Adam the Computer, Crouch and others, and they're saying like the Superman's not too bad. You know, like I just feel it would be incumbent upon us to at least check one out in full as a trade.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's for the future. Now, next up, we had Friendly Spider-Man 1, Tom Taylor, Aussie Stew, Tom Taylor, coming from All New Wolverine and other things. I felt this was a very clean, non-cluttered issue. I felt we were in very safe hands with Tom Taylor. A lot was set up. The backup short featuring Aunt May was very good too.
Very dark, though.
The backup,
yeah.
Oh, the backup was super bleak with Aunt May.
Very dark.
Yeah, but the original story up front, like the 25 pages to begin with, wasn't dark. No. I felt it was very much like I'm coming on the Spider-Man title. Here's my setup. It was a very non-cluttered approach. I enjoyed it. Like I love Tom Taylor. I thought the art was very clean, but there was an emptiness about everything. Like it was.
It's good. You can see that he's clearly setting up.
Yeah.
Nothing groundbreaking. Nothing great at this point.
No.
But it's well worth continuing with, I think.
What would you give it? I gave it a 7.5 out of 10. I was interested to see what you would give it.
I gave it a 7. Yeah. I think it's well worth the read. If you're a Spider-Man fan, stick with it. Give it the first 5 or 10 issues.
For sure. Like already I feel I'm in better hands than Dan Slott, you know?
I don't know. I think Dan had a much better start.
Yeah, maybe. Well, he did have a good start. He did have a very good start.
I think if you compare the first 5 issues Slott with Taylor,
sure,
Slott's probably going to come out in front.
Coming from All New Wolverine, which I really enjoyed, I have a lot of time for Tom Taylor's writing. Like, I'm prepared to give him a chance here. But I will say this. I did feel it was very non-cluttered, almost to the point where that was a bit of a distraction from... Not a distraction, but it wasn't the world's most ambitious story. is what I'm trying to sort of say.
No, far from it.
Yeah, like, so it gets a 7.5 out of 10, and it's definitely watched this space. Finally, Stu, I did a bit of a left turn here. We had Star Wars Age of the Republic, Jango Fett, a one-shot, basically.
Yeah.
Featuring Jango Fett and a very young Boba Fett.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, for me, I liked it, actually, to be honest. I was a bit I'm always a little bit disconcerted by sometimes the artist, how they do, like, famously, of course, Temuera Morrison was revealed to be Jango Fett and the clone of him, blah, 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 in the prequels. I felt, and in this one, very much his face is used, his visual image is used in the comic. For me, dragged me out of it slightly, but regardless, I enjoyed this for what it was. I actually found this reasonably interesting. What did you think?
I think the fact that they use his likeness actually helped a lot.
Yeah, okay.
I knew exactly when it was set time-wise. They showed it was more or less when he was still working with the Kamino employers, trying to figure out whether he could make a clone.
Sure. And they were developing that, weren't they?
Yeah, he was kind of signing the contract at one point in a little flashback.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is set slightly after that because he does have the Boba Fett child. Mm. I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was a great little one-shot.
It's a nice little one-shot. Like, I'd give this an 8 out of 10. I actually was kind of like, yeah, this is cool. I'm glad I put it in there. Because
I gave it a 9. I thought this was a great one.
Excellent. I'm pleased because I think some of the stuff... I keep saying to you, this Darth Vader that Marvel's doing, the comic, it's amazing, Stu.
Yeah.
It's as good, almost as good as any comic from any current publisher that I've read in the last 5 years. And I think some of the stuff Marvel is doing with the Star Wars franchise is fantastic. So we will do more Star Wars comics on the show, and I think we're going to try to do more modern stuff to kind of be a bit more current. So I think we'll probably do Darth Vader down the track. We'll probably do Star Wars down the track, whatever. But, yeah, I'm really glad I picked this one on a whim, and I thought it was – I gave it an 8. You gave it a 9, Stu.
Yeah.
Okay. Turning to Trade of the Week, Booster Gold, Jeff Johns. Dan Juergens, the co-creator of Booster Gold on art. I'm going to basically kick this off. This is set after 52, the comic, where basically Booster assisted somewhat and is close to getting his Justice League membership back. But he's being warned that if he takes a Justice League membership, which he's always kind of coveted since he lost it, and he's always the thing about Booster Gold was he was going to be the world's biggest hero. That was in his destiny, apparently. And he came back from the future with stolen artifacts to try to accomplish that dream. And basically, this is set after 52. Rip Hunter is the Time Master, is saying to Booster, you need to help me fix abnormalities in the time stream. And what follows is a really, I felt, really good walk through some DC moments over the course of the next 5 or 6 issues. Booster trying to do things like, for example, save Batgirl from being crippled. Also, his goal is to try to save Blue Beetle, who died, I think, in Infinite Crisis, was killed by Maxwell Lord. Man, I really found this very readable and page-turning, like a good Jeff Johns comic, where you're like, it might not be like a 10 out of 10, but it's a real page-turner. And I was really quite invested. I read this over the course of about 2 days. And the last read, I had about 80 pages to go, Stu. And it was like about 3 or issues. And I was like, bang, bang, bang. And I had one more issue to go. I was like, fuck, I'm going to read it right now. Because it was one about Blue Beetle where he tries to rescue him. Yeah, I mean, I dug it. I wondered how you were because I know you don't have the same level of DC history. And this is very reliant on that. But what was your thoughts?
I didn't think it was that reliant on DC history.
Sure.
I thought the premise was brilliant. It was really well set up, and then it fumbled at the end.
Didn't like the end?
The fact that they spent so long going through the motion of you can't save Barbara Gordon from getting shot, like...
I like that issue.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
The whole point that there are some points in time that you cannot change...
Because time's solidified.
And it's a fact that you need to live with and move on.
Mm.
There was a chance for them to have a really cool emotional arc showing Booster kind of having to deal with the fact that he's not going to get Ted Kord back.
Well, I don't know if he does. I don't know if that lasts.
But then in the very next issue, they revert the whole thing because this Beetle comes back and says, oh, no, I can do it. I've got a wave that changes time.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fucking terrible.
I don't know.
They wasted 4 or 5 issues of really good work and good setup.
Mm.
And they just said, by the way, everything you've done so far, redundant because I've got a button that does it all.
Now, to your point, not having read it, I'm not sure if the resurrection of Blue Beetle lasts in that timeline. Don't quote me on it. I haven't read it. I know he's around today in DC, but I've got a feeling that might not last past the next issue, actually. Because the trade ends basically on a cliffhanger, right? Come back next episode for the adventures of Blue Beetle and Booster. But I'm not sure if that was a permanent resurrection. I've got a feeling it wasn't. But I'm not sure. But I agree with you. If it does last, it was kind of a fake out, because they made a Rip Hunter the whole way through was saying, we can't go back. Well, at first he said, look, I'll go back and save Blue Beetle if you do all this stuff for me. He then does all this stuff for Rip Hunter. And then Rip Hunter then says, okay, now go and save Barbara Gordon. One of my favourite issues. That was really well done.
Yeah, and he tries and tries again.
Yeah, the Killing Joke.
And he just can't do it.
He inserts himself into the Killing Joke narrative, and he just can't stop her being crippled. And then it's revealed, the Rip Hunter says, see, I'm just trying to prove to you that you can't stop something that's solidified. And it then leads to, I want to do Blue Beetle anyway. These Blue Beetles come back. But I've got a feeling that that might not have been a forever solution. I've got a feeling the Blue Beetle may actually be gone by the next issue.
Like, I don't think it matters. I think the fact that they brought in a character very next issue that said,
sure,
what you've been reading and invested in, I can do with a single button, made the last four comics feel cheap.
Okay.
And that in itself was just a...
Didn't like it.
Poor way to run a story.
To me, that was just typical sort of sci-fi comic book stuff, though.
No, but for me, there were so many opportunities for them to say, we can do it, but we have to create another rip in the universe and create a problem that you've then got to fix later.
Yeah.
And maybe bring it back that way and have him be the one that has to kill Blue Beetle to fix the problem in time.
It wasn't well explained.
There are brilliant stories they could have run with. Mm. There are other options that...
There was almost no story, though. They just came back. It was almost like, if you're reading it, you know how you can read comics kind of the fast version, which is kind of what I do a lot of time? It almost wasn't explained. They were just back, and then they just went back. And there wasn't sort of a very sort of complicated explanation behind it all.
No, I felt the villains fell flat as well. The when his dad was there,
Well, that came from nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, yes. Look, it's not perfect. Like the thing they sort of said that, like, I know not that much about Booster Gold other than he comes back from the future and he's the cheesy guy, like what we know from 52, remember?
Yeah,
like that's all I know of him too. Like, I'm not hugely, you know, au fait with every move,
but the first couple of issues in this series explained where he was coming from, explained why he did what he did. They teamed him up with Rip Hunter really well. The fact that they were traveling in the time stream and ran into Flash.
I love that.
On his treadmill. I thought, like, things like that were really well done. If they'd kept with that,
well, I think
it would have been a really cool story. And then they confused it with the other time sphere, which was helmed by his dad.
That came from nowhere.
Rex Hunter instead of Rip Hunter.
Well, the dad just felt like Booster had made a couple of comments where he sort of pinned the reason that he threw the football game, which led to his demise, on his dad. And then suddenly the dad turns up and he's the villain. I'm like, okay, this was a bit lazy. Like,
It feels like there were the bones of a really good, solid trade here and a really good story.
Well,
and they went 80% of the way and then kind of fumbled it at the end constantly.
To be fair, though, you know what I did? As soon as I finished reading this trade, I downloaded on my Comixology Volume 2. I was kind of like, I'm invested in the story. I hear your point, but it's a continuing series. Like, it doesn't end at Volume 1. Like, it's, you know...
No, I know, but as a single trade, I felt it just kind of got 80% of the way and then fumbled.
Yeah, but...
On a couple of fronts.
I hear you, but I would suggest... Like, I hear your point, frankly, but a lot of these trades... There aren't natural stopping points all the time. I've heard creators say this before, like, the point where they split it for a trade isn't actually the end of any story. Like,
yeah, no, I'm well aware of that, but we are here to review this trade.
No, I know, but like,
and as this trade goes,
yeah, but for me,
it fumbles at the end.
For me, that end, or I hear your point, but for me, I was like, man, I'm excited to read the next one, and I've got a feeling that he doesn't last. I more from what I think I'm remembering, I think there was a bit of an outcry at the time. There was a big push from DC fan base to bring Blue Beetle back when he was killed. Like, a big push. And I think Geoff Johns was probably, you know, hearing that outcry. It was a big thing at DC because Blue Beetle had a lot of storylines at the time that were rotating through different titles. Like through Birds of Prey, he was pretty much dating Barbara Gordon, which is touched on in this story,
mm-hmm.
and various things. And he was kind of killed fairly abruptly by Maxwell Lord, which I actually really enjoyed that conclusion where Booster was inserting himself into that. I thought that was kind of well done. It was very sort of like, it reminded me of like many a sci-fi TV show. Like, I don't know, I kind of got a kick out of it. I hear your point that it invalidated sort of the stakes, but I still was kind of caught up in the action. Like, I thought it was pretty cool that Booster went back with the Blue Beetles to save Blue Beetle from Maxwell Lord, and I sort of enjoyed that interaction. I hear your point, though.
I did like that. I felt it probably could have been set up a little better.
More time, maybe, on it, I thought would have been better.
It felt a little rushed with the Blue Beetles.
Yes.
Teaming up and getting just literally plucked from history.
Now, well, one second you're watching, you're reading Barbara Gordon, the next second they're there and we're going back in time, and I was kind of like, have I missed an issue?
Yeah, well, it felt like you were missing a page or two.
Yes, that's exactly, I agree.
Because you kind of jumped to this other setting where a Blue Beetle would drag another Blue Beetle out of history, and then they disappear, and that was it. It was a single page.
Yeah.
Like, run in the middle of another book about Booster Gold, and yes. I'm kind of, it felt thrown in there after the fact.
It felt like he was almost not confident in the sales and was just rushing the story.
Well, it felt like he'd penned five or six issues and then gone, oh, we actually need a team of Beatles to show up.
Yeah.
And I don't want to have them show up and spend a whole issue telling how they formed. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to split it up and do five pages across five issues and do it that way. And
which doesn't serve the story that well in terms of a payoff for a reader, especially if you're not reading and very intently.
Yeah, that's the third area where I felt it's a good story, it's a good concept, but they kind of fumbled the execution a little bit.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I'd probably give it a soft 7.5. I could be argued to a 7. I enjoyed it. I thought the art was also very good. Dan Jurgens on art, I thought, did a very nice job.
Dan Jurgens was writing, not on art.
No, Geoff Johns was writing. Dan Jurgens was on art. This is a Geoff Johns written.
Oh, of course, yeah. Sorry.
Dan Jurgens often writes and was a co-creator of Booster Gold, but he was on art for these issues. I would give it a 7.5, and you know, I could be argued to down to a 7. Or where were you?
I'm at a 6.5.
Okay. Well, yeah.
It is a good read.
Yeah.
Somewhat
flawed.
It's definitely flawed. There are mistakes that I feel were pretty easy to avoid, yet they kind of walked into them willingly.
Can I say this is the kind of DC that I enjoy from Geoff Johns, though? Like, this is the, like, it's not fucking world beating, but I find it very much a page turner. You know, like, I don't know. I kind of miss this kind of style of storytelling a little bit. I found it was kind of dragging me into the story. Yeah, I hear Stu's points, and to be honest, especially the insertion of the Beatles at the end in the last issue is very sudden. And it's almost not explained. It's explained in a very kind of like, you know, backhand way. But overall, I thought it was enjoyable. You know what I mean? I'd almost put it on par with watching a TV show that you're sort of watching without thinking this is the greatest thing ever. But, like, I'm enjoying it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think 7.5, I'd probably give it. Maybe I'm being slightly generous, but fuck it, who cares? Like, you know, 7 to 7.5. I'm off to, I would say, a decent start in 2019. That was my first trade.
That's not a bad start at all.
Not a bad start. Like, and look, are you going to read Volume 2? Because I was sort of like, man, I want to read Volume 2. I want to find out if this beetle hangs around. I was a bit sort of caught up in the story.
Look, it was certainly easy to read.
Yeah.
For me, there's things that I would rather read, but it's not that this is bad and I wouldn't continue. Look, if you're a Booster Gold fan,
you'd enjoy this. Yeah, you've got to get this. If you're a Booster Gold fan, this is a pretty cool issue.
Look, if you're a DC fan in general, it's certainly enjoyable.
And that's where I come in more, because I'm more of a DC kind of fan.
I mean, it's certainly enjoyable. Don't get us wrong. Like, no,
definitely.
A 7.5 and a 6.5, like, we're averaging like a 7 out of 10.
That's a very decent score.
Absolutely it is. So don't be put off. I think that there are problems. They may be addressed in the next issue, next volume.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they are or not.
Like,
he's certainly around in Heroes in Crisis, if you recall Blue Beetle.
For me, it just feels a little clumsy. Like, it's not up to the caliber I expect from this creative team.
Sure. sure.
Because these two are big names.
Oh, huge like names.
Geoff Johns and Dan Jurgens. Like, they're both
players,
well-respected names.
Yeah.
And you kind of expect quite a bit.
And Geoff Johns was just coming off 52. Geoff Johns was at his peak, you know, like in terms of comic book output.
Yeah.
He was pumping through. He was the king of DC at this time.
And boy, do they like referencing 52.
Well, they've just come out of 52.
I know, but they really love referencing it in this book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was huge at DC at that time. They kept doing that for a few years. Because 52 was the weekly one, and it sold a lot of copies. It made a lot of the covers of newspapers. You know, it hit the mainstream.
Yeah.
In a weird way, and this is sort of the 52 fans, I think, who enjoyed the booster arc. Because remember, there was a big booster arc in 52?
Yeah.
He's definitely, and this is kind of expanding upon that. Now, Stu, have you come up with a trade for next week?
I have. It's a shaky pick. I've no idea if it's
going to go
well.
Shaky pick? Well, it's not like you to be...
it's very left of centre, but we'll see what happens.
What is it, Stu?
Can you we're going to go with the Pet Avengers run.
Jesus.
Lockjaw and the Pet Avengers. Volume 1.
Jesus. Volume 1. Oh, volume okay, one. Right, okay. Wow, Stu.
First trade, it's only 4 issues. It's a very quick read.
Okay, all right. Well, so, I've heard some people have enjoyed it. Like, I know Connor from Into the Night's a big fan of Pet Avengers. Okay, Stu, well, you're really starting off 2019 with, I feel, one of the shakiest picks of all time for you. Like, I mean, let's hope this doesn't turn into some of my speculative choices over the years.
Who knows? I've already got a solid hit under my belt, so I'm okay.
You do too.
Well, speculating week 2.
Pet Avengers. Well, did you just throw names into a hat and come out with that, or what?
More or less, yeah.
Fair enough. Well,
more or less, yes.
There's only one way that we'll find out, and that'll be by reviewing it next week.
I'm hoping it's going to be a quick, quirky kind of read.
You said 4 issues, didn't you?
It's only a 4 issue.
I do like your 4-issue arc, man. Like, it's got that tick of approval from me.
I know. That's the trick, you know. If you're going to go speculative, go short and speculative.
Yeah, not like Aliens versus Predator Omnibus that time.
Dave. No, we don't.
Crisis on Infinite Earth speculative, like a fucking 4,000 pages.
Read a billion pages of mediocre comics.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Now, Stu, any thoughts for listeners? I do want to do a shout-out to and thank you to all the people who reached out about the Chuck Dixon interview. I had Punisher and Conan fans saying how much they enjoyed that interview. And thank you for that. Chuck was very giving with his time. And we're looking forward to more creators and more interviews in 2019. So that it's always good. It takes a fair bit of research, Stu, to do these interviews. And as Stu knows, research sometimes isn't my favourite thing.
Hard to copy and paste research.
I know. You have to do a bit more like thinking and like reading and all sorts of things come into the equation. Please follow us on Facebook, the Signal of Doom fan book page, or Facebook page, I guess it's called. We're doing quite well there. Obviously, we're on Twitter and at Red Lantern 2051 and part of a member of the collective. Any final thoughts over there, Stu?
Look, get involved in social media. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, get involved. Just in general, should they just be getting involved or getting involved signal-specific?
Signal-specific.
Keep it signal-specific.
If you're on social media for anything else, you're wasting your time.
Yeah, just boost the signal.
It's signal and
boost
then log off.
Signal of boom. What you need to do. Log off. Like, and then
jump
you
on, check the
like.
Signal. We're still here. Good. Log off. World is fine.
Exactly. On that note, good night.
See you next week.